You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with the August 9th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Today, August 9th, marks the 72nd anniversary of the atomic bombing at the Japanese city of Nagasaki by the United States Air Force. It was not only one of the most shameful moments in the history of this country, but also, I will argue, the most egregious act of state terror ever committed by the people of one country against the people of another. From a moral perspective, I consider it to have been worse than the bombing of Hiroshima. And why do I make that distinction? Because despite having been made aware of the extent of death and devastation in Hiroshima, President Truman and his military advisors went ahead with their plans to drop a second bomb of a different type on another Japanese city to see if the effects were comparable. None of the war criminals responsible for these atrocities were ever brought to trial, and no attempt was made to do so. And to my knowledge, none ever apologized. Nor were they expected to by the majority of American public conditioned to see the Japanese as less than human, as in future wars they would view Koreans and Vietnamese. President Obama was the first American president to visit Hiroshima. He did so on last year's anniversary of the bombing, but he was not about to offer America's apology for its crimes. That was established in the media before his trip. Had he done so, of course, in a sudden attack of conscience, he would have been pilloried by the same media and Congress. But then, while on the same trip, he also couldn't bring himself to apologize to either the Vietnamese or Laotians for the unspeakable war crimes the U.S. had committed against the peoples of both of those countries. Americans don't apologize, was his unspoken message to the world. Like it or not, and I don't, it is who we are. Estimates of the number of dead and injured in both bombings made by American officials, 175,000 in Hiroshima and half of that in Nagasaki, are thought by critics of the bombing to be understated. The extent and type of devastation made accurate body counts impossible. The U.S. testing of ever more powerful bombs over the Marshall Islands, and particularly the Bikini Atoll, in the subsequent decades have been largely forgotten, except by the survivors and their descendants, whose lives and lands were made permanently uninhabitable. Following the first bombing of Bikini in 1946, a French fashion designer, Louis Rayard, produced a woman's swimsuit and named it after the demolished island, presumably because, like the atoll, there wasn't much left to see. All this is relevant today because for the first time since the end of the Cold War, the threat of nuclear war that would engulf the world is not a fantasy, and the fear of mad, mutually assured destruction that held it back no longer seems to anchor reality. Is it any surprise that actions by the United States have been largely responsible for this new threat, and that Russia is once again cast in the role of our adversary? Beginning with Washington's unquestioned role in promoting the 2014 Ukraine coup and using Russia's clearly anticipated reaction to that event, the retaking of Crimea, as justification to move NATO's troops to Russia's borders, followed by the yet-to-be-proven accusation that Moscow interfered in our presidential election, the confrontation between the world's two nuclear powers is moving dangerously apace. It should also not be forgotten that President Obama, who had promised a cutback in America's nuclear arsenal when he came into office, used Russia's annexation of Crimea as an excuse to set the United States upon a trillion-dollar path to replace what he described as aging missile silos, 1950s-era bombers, and other outdated technology. The Nobel Peace Prize winner described the steps as intended to maintain America's present capabilities into the future, not bulking up to prepare for a nuclear war. The most recent aggressive act on Washington's part was Congress's approval by almost unanimous votes in both houses of the harshest sanctions on Russia to date, as well as adding sanctions on Iran and North Korea. Those sanctions have not gone down well with any of their targets, but those against Russia have angered our European allies, whose important commercial relations with Moscow these sanctions were apparently designed to scuttle. Both of those subjects, the increasing danger of nuclear war and Europe's response to the imposition of the new sanctions, are what I will be discussing at 20 minutes past the hour with an old friend, Paris-based journalist Diana Johnstone. We'll be speaking about a recent article on Counterpunch called Collateral Damage, U.S. Sanctions Aimed at Russia Strike Western European Allies, and From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon Nuclear War Planning, a deathbed memoir by her father, Paul Johnstone, former senior analyst in the Strategic Weapons Evaluation Group in the Pentagon, and a co-author of the Pentagon Papers, which was issued in paperback on April 1st. Speaking of Congress, in her Counterpunch article, Johnstone asks, do they realize that the measures amount to a declaration of economic war against their European friends? Whether they know it or not, they obviously don't care. U.S. politicians, she writes, view the rest of the world as America's hinterland to be exploited, abused, and ignored with impunity. That's from Diana Johnstone, and we will be hearing more from her at 20 minutes past, so stay tuned. One more important item relating to the sanctions is worth noting, since the mainstream and alternative media have ignored it, which is particularly significant because those added sanctions on Russia were based on the still-not-proven allegations of Russian hacking of Democratic Party emails. On July 24th, the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, a group of former employees of the CIA, NSA, FBI, etc., several of whom you have heard on this and other programs on KZYX, sent a memo to President Trump challenging the conclusions of the U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia was the guilty party. According to the report's executive summary, quote, forensic studies of Russian hacking into the Democratic National Committee computers last year revealed that on July 5, 2016, data was leaked, not hacked, by a person with physical access to DNC computers and then doctored to incriminate Russia. After examining metadata from Guccifer II, July 15, 2016 intrusion into the DNC server, the memo continued, independent cyber investigators have concluded that an insider copied DNC data onto an external storage drive and that telltale signs implicating Russia were then inserted. Key among the findings of the independent forensic investigations is the conclusion the DNC data was copied onto a storage device at a speed that far exceeds an internet capability for a remote hack. The last line was in boldface for emphasis and worth repeating. The DNC data was copied onto a storage device at a speed that far exceeds an internet capability for a remote hack. End quote. Of equal importance, the memo continued, the forensics showed the copying and doctoring were performed on the East Coast of the U.S. Thus far, mainstream media have ignored the findings of these independent studies. End quote. Only two U.S. publications, the Washington Times and the Baltimore Sun, carried their report, or story of their report. Who were these former intelligence professionals whose opinion the U.S. media did not want the public to know about? The most familiar names of the 17 who signed it are probably Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst during the Reagan administration, and Colleen Rowley, formerly with the FBI, whose whistleblowing made national news. Then there's William Binney, former NSA Technical Director for World Geopolitical and Military Analysis and co-founder of NSA's Signals Intelligence Automation Research Center. Kirk Wabey, a former senior analyst also at the NSA's Signals Intelligence Automation Research Center, and John Kiraku, former CIA counterterrorism officer and former senior investigator of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You can find the entire memo, published on Consortium News July 24th, online under the headline, Intel Vets Challenge Russia Hack Evidence. North Korea is another story. President Trump unfortunately took time off of his golfing vacation yesterday to warn North Korea that it would face, quote, fire and fury like the world has never known if it threatened the United States. Sure enough, just hours later, two North Korean generals responded that their country is, quote, carefully examining, end quote, plans for a missile strike on the U.S. Pacific colony of Guam, home base of the strategic bombers that have begun to routinely fly over the Korean Peninsula as a demonstration of U.S. air power. If there's any good news to be taken from this story, is that it was the generals responding to President Trump, not Kim Jong-un. On another front, there appears to be no end to the New York Times pandering to those whose interest would be served by the U.S. either breaking the nuclear deal with Iran, actually launching an attack on Tehran, or sending thousands more troops to Afghanistan to prevent the Iranians from filling the vacuum that would be caused by an American withdrawal. A week ago Sunday, The Times, which has lied to the American people about every war or overseas misadventure the U.S. has engaged in since World War II, ran a 4,000-word article based largely on hearsay that will lead the paper's readers to believe that Iran has taken over Iraq and Syria and will do the same in Afghanistan unless thousands more U.S. soldiers are sent there to prevent it. The best remedy for that piece of propaganda is to take a look at a map of the U.S. military bases in the area. They show Iran to be completely surrounded. Some good news. Listeners to Takes on the World 2 weeks ago heard Grant Smith of IRMEP, the Institute for Research for Middle Eastern Policy, break down the serious problems inherent in the Anti-Israel Boycott Act, SB 720, currently being sponsored by a majority of members of the House and nearly half the Senate. The bill would make advocating or participating in boycotting, sanctioning, or divesting from Israel a felony punishable by up to $1 million in fines and 20 years in prisons. Not kidding. It would also amend certain critical U.S. statutes to make fair binding U.S. law. For those who have heard me describe Congress as Israel's most important occupied territory, the progress of such legislation pushed by AIPAC comes as no surprise. But what will come as a surprise, and much welcome one, is that Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, elected to the Senate seat vacated by Hillary Clinton when she first ran for president, has made history by becoming the first U.S. senator to ask to have her name removed from a piece of AIPAC-promoted legislation. At two town hall meetings last month, Gillibrand promised to reconsider her co-sponsorship of the bill after a number of her constituents raised free speech concerns to rousing applause. It did not take long for AIPAC, recognizing the historic nature of Gillibrand's challenge, to begin mobilizing its troops against her. The first strike was an email from Brian Tregerman, AIPAC's director for Westchester and Riverdale, New York, on August 2nd. The subject line read, "Urgent. We need your help from Senator Gillibrand." And that began the message. New York's junior Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has withdrawn her co-sponsorship of the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, sending a powerful message to her constituents that she no longer supports the fight to combat the international delegitimization of Israel. Please call Senator Gillibrand's office today at 202-224-4451 and remind her how crucial this bill is in combating the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement and reaffirming congressional support for Israel, end quote. This was followed by a suggesting sample telephone message and a list of talking points, the first and most interesting one being that, quote, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, Senate Bill 720, would expand existing U.S. anti-boycott laws to international governmental organizations like the United Nations and the European Union, end quote, implying that actions of both these organizations that include America's closest allies are illegitimate. You will recall in my last program I discussed with Grant Smith the unsuccessful efforts of President Kennedy to have Israel's lobbying organization at the time, American Zionist Council, and his staff register as agents of a foreign country. Smith also described his own well-documented efforts to have JFK's wishes realized and how those were thwarted by the Justice Department's Foreign Agents Registration Agency. If AIPAC was registered as a foreign agent, it could not have sent such messages to voters as was done in the case of Gillibrand, and we would not see congressional legislation that would scrap our First Amendment and further enshrine Israel within the inner workings of the U.S. government. Quite out of the blue, the question whether AIPAC should have to register as a foreign agent was raised by none other than Senator Lindsey Graham at the hearings of the Senate Judiciary Committee on possible Russian involvement in the U.S. political process. Listen to him asking the question of Adam Hickey, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Justice Department's National Security Division, and the mealy-mouthed answer he gets in response.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to add my compliments to you and the ranking member for conducting a very organized way forward in terms of dealing with the threats we face as a nation and changing our laws consistent with those threats. I am too disappointed that we have a two-hour rule on something that's important. two hearings I know of have been canceled because we can't agree on health care, but we should be able to agree this is important. Mr. Browder's got a lot to say. So here's the deal. AIPAC, are you familiar with AIPAC? American Israeli Political Action Committee.
I have heard of it, sir, yes.
Okay. They come up here in droves, lobbying Congress to do things, in their view, good for the U.S.-Israel relationship. I know they have a lot of contacts in Israel. Should somebody like that be a foreign agent?
Sir, it's probably not appropriate for me to comment on a particular entity, but I think you've hit on something very important to us, which is right now we rely principally on public reports for the basis to send voluntary letters of inquiry. I would love to receive more information in whatever form anyone can give it to me about what's occurring behind closed doors so we are able to take steps to investigate if appropriate.
In November 2009, as you heard, 2 weeks ago, Grant Smith met for 2 hours with the head and staff members of the Foreign Agents Registration Agency of the Justice Department and presented them with more than 300 pages of evidence, including files that had been recently declassified, clearly establishing beyond a doubt that AIPAC was working as a foreign agent for Israel and calling on the agency to register as such. Grant Smith never heard from them again. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. In 2006, two professors, John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago and Stephen Wolt of Harvard University, wrote a paper called The Israeli Lobby and the U.S. Foreign Policy. It was a controversial unveiling of the secretive Israeli lobby and its disproportionate effect on our foreign policy. It had to be published initially in England. No one would publish it here. It led to a book, and the Israeli lobby, which loves to operate in the dark, was exposed. Mearsheimer and Walt were attacked by the Israeli propaganda machine, but truth will out. The book is held up under intense scrutiny. Our feature presentation this morning is a keynote address delivered by Professor John Mearsheimer before a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, where he examines where we have come from since the publication of the article and the book, and what has changed and what has not. Here is University of Chicago Professor John Mearsheimer.
It's a special pleasure to introduce our first keynote speaker, Professor John Mearsheimer. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. In March of 2006, he and Professor Stephen Walt of Harvard published an article in the London Review of Books titled The Israel Lobby. The article had originally been commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly, but that American publication decided not to publish it after all. So instead, it found a home overseas. The paper's publication caused an uproar, in no small part because it shed light on what AIPAC operative Steve Rosen described as a night flower that thrives in the dark and shrivels up in the sunlight. Harvard posted the paper on its website but removed its logo. And attacks on Mearsheimer and Walt ranged from naive, that from Noam Chomsky, to, and this will shock you, anti-Semites. The following year, their article evolved into the book The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which has since been translated into 22 languages. Professor Mearsheimer, by the way, will be signing copies of his book at 12:15 at the registration table where he signed in. I'm also particularly glad that he is joining us today because every year people ask us if he is going to be speaking at our conference. So it's been a great pleasure this year to be able to say, of course he is. Today he will be discussing what, if anything, has changed in the decades since the Israel Lobby was published. Please join me in welcoming Professor John Mearsheimer.
Thank you for the kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here today to speak before this distinguished audience. I would like to thank IRMEP and the Washington Report for inviting me to give this talk. Of course, I thank all of you for coming out to hear me and the other speakers. I would like to focus my talk on what has transpired regarding the Israel lobby and the U.S.-Israeli relationship in the 10 years since Steve Walt and I wrote The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. My talk's comprised of four parts. I'll begin by briefly restating the core arguments in our book. I'll then describe four major changes that have taken place regarding the lobby and the U.S.-Israeli relationship over the past decade. I will then describe what has not changed and conclude by speculating about the future. The central argument in the book is that the United States has a special relationship with Israel that has no parallel in modern history, and it is almost wholly due to the lobby. What makes Israel's relationship with the United States extraordinary is not simply the fact that Israel has received more foreign aid than any other country, or that Washington almost always backs Israel diplomatically. What makes it truly special is that the aid is given unconditionally. In other words, Israel gets this aid even when it does things that the United States opposes, like building settlements in the West Bank. This discussion raises the obvious question: why does the United States give Israel so much aid and without any conditions? Israel's supporters sometimes argue that it is because Israel is a vital strategic asset. This is not a serious argument. In fact, giving Israel nearly unconditional support is one of the reasons we have a terrorism problem. Others argue that there's a moral rationale for the special relationship. Israel is said to be a democracy that shares our values. The two countries certainly share some values, but Israel is a Jewish state which clearly privileges its Jewish citizens. Non-Jews are second-class citizens in both theory and practice. The United States, on the other hand, is a liberal democracy that works hard to treat all of its citizens equally. It certainly is not a Christian state that treats non-Christians as second-class citizens. Indeed, that kind of discrimination, which is part of Israel's essence, is antithetical to the American way of life. Furthermore, Israel's treatment of the Palestinians in the occupied territories is sharply at odds with U.S. values. Finally, there's the claim that the American people have such a favorable view of Israel that they demand their politicians back the special relationship. This argument, however, is not persuasive. If you look at the survey data on how the American public thinks about Israel, as Grant made clear before I spoke, there's no question that Americans have a generally favorable image of Israel, in part because media coverage tends to be favorable. But as poll after poll shows, that support is not especially deep or wide. So what explains the special relationship if there is no strategic or moral imperative, and if most Americans do not favor it? Our answer, of course, is the lobby. What exactly is the lobby? Steve and I argue that it's a loose coalition of individuals and groups who actively work to influence U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. It's not a centralized organization, and the groups that make up the lobby do not agree on every issue. It includes organizations like AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the Conference of Presidents, the Zionist Organization of America, and Christians United for Israel, just to name a few. It also includes think tanks like YNAP and the American Enterprise Institute, and publications like the Weekly Standard and Commentary. It certainly is not a cabal or a conspiracy that, quote-unquote, controls U.S. foreign policy. Rather, it's a powerful interest group like the NRA, the Farm Lobby, the Cuba Lobby, or the AARP. And it operates pretty much the same way those other interest groups do. Very importantly, the lobby is not synonymous with Jewish Americans. Surveys suggest that about a third of American Jews do not care that much about Israel. Others do not support the lobby's positions, and some groups that work on Israel's behalf, such as the so-called Christian Zionists, are not Jewish. In short, the lobby is defined by its political agenda, not by ethnicity or religion. Finally, we argue that the lobby has pushed policies that are in neither Israel's or America's national interests. In particular, we maintain that it would have been much better for both countries if the United States had long ago pressured Israel to stop building settlements and allow for the creation of a viable Palestinian state. But this did not happen, and it will not happen, because the lobby makes it impossible for American leaders to use the leverage at their disposal to pressure Israel. In essence, that's the story Steve and I tell. Let me now switch gears and talk about what has changed regarding Israel and the lobby since the book was first published in 2007. I think that there have been four noteworthy changes. First, there has been a fundamental change in how Americans think and talk about Israel, the special relationship, and the lobby. When we initially wrote our book, there was much ignorance about these subjects. And my sense is that most people who read our book or who have read our book thought there was a large element of truth in what we said, but that we had nevertheless exaggerated the lobby's influence. There was also a great deal of ignorance in the American body politic about Israeli policies, especially toward the Palestinians, and little understanding of the special relationship. This is hardly surprising because one of the lobby's main goals is to prevent an open conversation in the media about Israeli policy, the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and the lobby itself. It was successful for a long time, but my sense from talking to many people about these matters and from closely following the public discourse is that those days are over. For example, it's commonplace, even in the mainstream media, to talk about the lobby using just that word. And I cannot tell you how many people have said to me that, if anything, Steve and I just scratched the surface in our discussion of the lobby's power and influence. I might add that there is now more discussion of Israel's policies and actions in the American media. And if you read the comments section that follow many newspaper stories, you will see that there are a substantial number of Americans who are critical of Israeli behavior, especially toward the Palestinians. And only someone who is blind and deaf would not recognize that the United States is deeply committed to defending Israel's behavior at almost every turn. In short, there is much more awareness of these critical issues today than there was a decade ago. What's caused this change? I think that our original article and the book helped. Both attracted an enormous amount of attention. Indeed, the lobby book made the New York Times bestseller list, and because of the internet, the article on which the book was based was widely read all over the world. But I think that ultimately our arguments would not have had much impact were it not for a number of other factors. First, the actions of Israel and the lobby over the past decade have done much to substantiate many of the claims we made in the book. Just to take one example, consider how Israel and the lobby responded to the Iran nuclear deal. Prime Minister Netanyahu went to extraordinary lengths to sabotage the agreement, going so far as to give a speech to a joint session of Congress on March 3, 2015, that not only sought to undermine the deal, but was also an indirect attack on President Obama. Of course, he was aided by AIPAC, which went all out to defeat the deal. This nasty fight between Netanyahu and the lobby on one hand and the Obama administration on the other hand played out in full public view. The second factor behind the increased awareness of Israeli policy and the lobby is the internet and social media. There are now all sorts of places on the internet one can go to for information about these subjects. The website Mondo Weiss, which I am sure everyone in this room knows about, is a case in point. It posts a steady stream of stories that reveal important information about Israeli policy and the lobby's activities, not to mention critical assessments of those matters. Mondo Weiss, which is now 11 years old, had 8 million visits to its site in 2016. Of course, there are other sites that provide valuable information, like the Electronic Intifada, which is run by Ali Abu Neiba, and the site for the Israeli magazine Plus972. Another important source of information on the internet is Haaretz, the liberal Israeli newspaper, which often runs pieces that take a critical perspective on Israel as well as the lobby. And in the age of Twitter, important pieces that appear on these sites are immediately spread around the world to huge numbers of people. These same pieces are also circulated on email lists that go to hundreds, if not thousands, of interested readers. Third, there are a host of organizations that are willing to criticize Israel and the lobby. IRMEP is a case in point, as it has played an important role in exposing the lobby's activities over time. There are also a number of organizations that are deeply committed to Israel, which nevertheless are willing to take Israel to task when they disapprove of its behavior. They include J Street, Jewish Voice for Peace, Americans for Peace Now, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, among others. Finally, there are some important voices in the mainstream media who have taken to speaking critically about Israeli policy and the lobby. The most important person in this regard is Peter Beinart, who wrote a very influential article in the June 2010 issue of the New York Review of Books entitled "The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment," which is critical of the lobby for aiding and abetting Israel's misguided policies in the occupied territories. He has continued to write and speak about these matters since this article appeared. And before Beinhart, there was the late Tony Judt, who offered searing criticisms of Israel and its American defenders. Of course, there are a number of other key figures in the mainstream media who have occasionally taken aim at both Israel and the lobby over the past decade. They would include Roger Cohen, Thomas Friedman, and Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, as well as Jon Stewart of Daily Show fame. In sum, I think there has been a significant change in how Americans think and talk about Israel since our book appeared. The second big change is that Israel's image in the West, especially in the United States, has suffered serious damage over the past decade. This is due in part to the fact that information about Israel is more readily available now than it was in the past, thanks in good part to the internet and social media. But it is also a result of the fact that things have been changing inside of Israel in recent years. For starters, the political center of gravity in Israel has been moving steadily rightward for decades, and it has now reached the point where government ministers occasionally make racist comments about Palestinians and write legislation that is directly at odds with basic liberal values. The recent legislation banning individuals who support BDS from entering Israel is the latest example of this phenomenon. All indications are that this rightward shift will continue for the foreseeable future, and Israel will become an increasingly illiberal country, even towards its own citizens. But the key stain on Israel's reputation is its brutal treatment of the Palestinians and the fact that it has become an apartheid state. Until recently, Israel and its supporters were able to maintain the fiction that there would eventually be a legitimate Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. But it is now clear that there is virtually no chance that will happen, and Greater Israel is here to stay. And that Greater Israel, as Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley make clear in an important new UN study, is already an apartheid state. Israel and its defenders vehemently deny that fact, but even among Israelis, it's not unusual to hear Israel described in as apartheid state. For example, two former Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, have said that if there is no two-state solution, there will be, Israel will, to quote Olmert, face a South African-style struggle. Well, there is no two-state solution. Speaking of South Africa, there are a number of individuals who were well acquainted with the situation in that racist state before it collapsed, who believe that the situation in Israel is worse. John Duggard, the eminent South African law professor, says that the crimes against the Palestinians are, to quote him, infinitely worse than those committed by the apartheid regime in South Africa, end of quote. He is hardly the lone voice in that regard. For anyone who doubts how bad life can be for the Palestinians living under Israeli control, one only has to consider what happened in Israel's three major assaults against Gaza over the past decade, Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense, and Operation Protective Edge. Because of time constraints, I will focus exclusively on the first of those operations, Cast Lead, which took place in the weeks before President Obama was inaugurated in 2009. Israeli forces killed about 1,400 Palestinians, of whom roughly 1,200 were civilians. 350 of those civilians were children. In contrast, 13 Israelis were killed. The ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed in that operation is 108-1. That's not a war in my lexicon. That's a massacre. I might add that 6,300 Palestinian homes were destroyed, contributing to the 600,000 tons of rubble that littered Gaza when the shooting ended. The UN commissioned an investigation in the wake of that conflict, which was headed by the distinguished South African jurist Richard Goldstone. The final report concluded that Israel had engaged in, quote, a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population, end of quote. It went on to accuse Israel of committing war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. There are other signs of serious trouble in Israel. Especially worrisome are the racist attitudes among large segments of Jewish Israeli youth. Given these attitudes, it is hardly surprising that a year ago today, a young Israeli soldier, shot and killed a wounded and defenseless Palestinian. Equally unsurprising, there was a huge outcry in Israel when he was indicted and later convicted of the reduced charge of manslaughter. Press reports from Israel make it clear that many Israelis thought his behavior was justified and that it was hardly an isolated incident. He simply had the misfortune of getting caught on film. The fact that the shooting was captured on film virtually guaranteed that it would go viral on social media and further damage Israel's image. The bottom line is that the days when Israel was seen as a morally upright David taking on an evil Goliath are over. The damage to Israel's reputation probably started in 1982 when it invaded Lebanon, but it has accelerated at a marked pace over the past decade. The third big change involves changes within the American Jewish community. One of the most important developments in recent years is a shift in the balance of power between the mainstream organizations in the lobby that reflexively support Israel's policies towards the Palestinians and a more progressive set of organizations that are determined to find a way to make peace between the two sides. The divide between those groups has long been present, but the balance of power between them has always been lopsided in favor of the organizations that support Israel no matter what it does. That situation, however, has begun to change, especially with the rise of J Street, which was created in November 2007 as a home for individuals with progressive views on Israel. It not only has a high profile, but it also is willing to criticize Israeli policies in the occupied territories and actually take on the hardline organizations in the lobby. J Street is surely not as powerful as an organization like AIPAC, but the mere fact that it has survived and is thriving shows that times are changing. After all, a similar organization called Brera was established in 1973, but the mainline forces in the lobby quickly crushed it. Not only has J Street survived, but there is good reason to think that it will grow in strength over time as increasing numbers of American Jews look to join institutions that challenge Israel's repressive policies towards the Palestinians. In addition to these changes in the Jewish establishment, there are changes taking place in the broader American Jewish community that do not bode well for either the lobby or Israel. In particular, it seems clear that younger Jews are not as committed to Israel as their parents and grandparents. For example, a Pew survey from 2013 found that among Jews who are 65 years or older, 53% say that caring about Israel is essential to being what Jewish means to me. That's 65 years or older, 53%. In contrast, 32% of American Jews under the age of 30 held a similar view. That is a gap of 21 percentage points. It seems likely that support for Israel in the American Jewish community, which has been weakening over the past decade, will weaken even more in the years ahead as generational change continues. Lastly, there's been an important change in Israel's support within the United States. For purposes of background, it's important to reemphasize that public support for Israel in the United States has never been particularly strong. One way that the lobby deals with this thin support is to have significant influence both inside the Democratic and Republican parties. In essence, the lobby has worked hard to make sure that Israel enjoys strong bipartisan support and is not strongly backed in one of the major parties, but not the other. The lobby was successful in this regard for a long time, but that bipartisan support has begun to erode over the past decade as support for Israel inside the Democratic Party has plummeted. At the same time, it has grown substantially inside the Republican Party. In a Pew poll from this past January, only 33% of Democrats said they sympathize more with the Israelis than the Palestinians, while 74% of Republicans said they sympathize more with Israel than the Palestinians. This is a gap of 41 percentage points. In short, there has been a marked erosion in support for Israel within the Democratic Party in recent years, which raises serious questions as to whether the lobby will be able to maintain bipartisan support for the special relationship in the years ahead. Let me switch gears again and now focus on what has not changed over the past decade. Three things have not changed. First, the lobby is as powerful as ever. One might be tempted to see the lobby's defeat on the Iran nuclear issue as evidence that its power is waning. But that would be a mistake. The lobby does not win every time, and it is most likely to lose when it is pushing the United States to do something that might get it into a war. The Iran deal fits squarely in that category. Its failure to make a deal with Tehran would have sharply increased the chances that the United States would have attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. Where the lobby almost always wins is on matters relating to the Palestinians and financial support for Israel. The fact that the Obama administration could do virtually nothing to get Israel to move toward a two-state solution, yet still opted to provide Israel with $38 billion in aid over the next decade is clear evidence that the lobby remains very powerful. It's important to understand that the key to the lobby's success is that it focuses mainly on influencing high-level policymakers and opinion makers, as well as the elites in both political parties, not the rank and file. I noted earlier that there has been a significant decrease in support for Israel within the Democratic Party. The reason that change has had little effect on policy is that the elites in the Democratic Party remain deeply committed to the special relationship. They fear the lobby will target them if there is any evidence they are wavering in their support for Israel. One might think that politicians who are supposed to place the American national interest above the interest of all other countries would stand up to the lobby when it pushes policies that they know are not good for the United States. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates explains why this does not happen. I saw most of Congress as uncivil, incompetent at fulfilling their basic constitutional responsibility, micromanagerial, parochial, hypocritical, egotistical, thin-skinned, and here are the key words, and prone to put self and re-election before country. The second big non-change is that U.S. policy toward Israel remains the same as it has been for the past decade. The special relationship, in other words, is firmly intact. Of course, this continuity is hardly surprising, given that there has been no diminishment in the power of the lobby. As many of you probably remember, there was a brief moment during the recent presidential election where it looked like candidate Trump might favor a more even-handed approach to dealing with Israel and the Palestinians. But he quickly reversed field and made it clear that he would go to great lengths to be even more pro-Israel than President Obama. Naturally, Hillary Clinton made the same pledge. Thus, there's no good reason to think that American policy toward Israel is going to change in a meaningful way anytime soon. Finally, there is hardly any sustained criticism of Israel in the American foreign policy establishment. This, too, is unsurprising since the lobby is as powerful as ever, and as I emphasized, it focuses most of its attention on keeping the country's elites in line. Anyone who wants to be a serious player in the making of U.S. foreign policy understands full well that if he or she criticizes Israel, there will be a price to pay. The result is that there is no serious debate about Israel or the special relationship in Congress, the mainstream media, or prominent think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations. This is not to deny, however, that there is an open and vigorous discussion of Israel and its relationship with the United States outside of these establishment institutions. Let me conclude by talking about where we go from here. I believe dark times are ahead for both Israel and the lobby. There's no reason to think Israel is going to move toward a two-state solution. Greater Israel is here to stay, and that state is and will remain an apartheid state. That brute fact will become increasingly clear to people all over the world, especially now that it is clear the Palestinians are not going to get a state of their own. Moreover, the Palestinians, who already comprise almost half of the population of Greater Israel, will continue to resist their oppression, which will force Israel to escalate the repressive policies that have already badly tarnished its image. The Palestinians' most potent weapon in this fight will be BDS, which is a global movement that aims to generate significant economic and political pressure on Israel that will ultimately force it to give the Palestinians equal rights. Israel and its supporters in the West view BDS as an existential threat because it not only has the potential to delegitimize Israel, but it might ultimately lead to Israel's undoing. After all, the Palestinians, if they were given equal rights, Israel would cease to be a Jewish state, as there eventually will be more Palestinians than Jews inside of Greater Israel. And there are good reasons to think that BDS might succeed, at least when it comes to delegitimizing Israel. First, it takes dead aim at apartheid, which is a morally repugnant political system that is universally condemned. Apartheid South Africa eventually disappeared. Why should Israel be any different? Second, the call to give the Palestinians equal rights is fully consistent with basic Western values. It's a demand that will surely resonate in Western Europe and the United States, causing all sorts of problems for Israel and its supporters. Of course, Israel and its supporters are counting on the lobby to stymie BDS. Over time, however, that will become an increasingly difficult task, simply because there is no good defense for apartheid, which is a reprehensible political system. Nevertheless, the lobby is extraordinarily powerful, and it will go to enormous lengths to protect Israel at every turn. It's difficult to say where this conflict will lead in the decades ahead. Many Israelis will surely be interested in expelling the Palestinians from Greater Israel if they have the opportunity, thereby eliminating the need for apartheid. But that outcome is unlikely because there are now more than 6 million Palestinians living within Greater Israel's borders, and they would surely put up fierce resistance if Israel tried to expel them from their homes. Moreover, massive ethnic cleansing would be an enormous and everlasting stain on Israel's reputation. It's more likely that Israel will simply remain an apartheid state and will help, and with the help of the lobby, just hunker down and accept the fact that most of the world considers it a pariah state. Finally, there's the possibility that BDS will carry the day and Greater Israel will become a legitimate liberal democracy. If that were to happen, which is not likely, it would undoubtedly come after much bloodshed, as most Israeli Jews would fervently oppose this outcome, since it would mean the end of the Zionist dream. Again, it's hard to say which one of these outcomes will carry the day. It will probably take another 20 or 30 years before we understand how this conflict will ultimately be resolved, or maybe not resolved. Regardless of the outcome, I am deeply sad to say that the decades ahead promise abundant trouble for Israel and especially for the Palestinians. And the United States will not be spared either, simply because the lobby will be working overtime to protect Israel and preserve the special relationship, which is likely to harm America's intellectual life as well as its politics. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mearsheimer. We have several questions. I want to start with one of my own. When you talk about the deteriorating image in the United States, do you think that's because people think it's because Israel has a right-wing government, and if it didn't have a right-wing government, these things wouldn't be happening?
Well, I think at a very general level, the deteriorating image is due to two factors. One is exposure because of alternative media, and number two, because of what's happening inside Israel. And I think that in part that is what's happening inside Israel is that the politicians who now are beginning to dominate the discourse that's there are unattractive from a liberal American point of view. And since the vast majority of American Jews are liberal, they are deeply bothered by what these politicians are saying. But I think that's not the key. I think the key is that it is becoming increasingly apparent that Israel is an apartheid state and that Israel's treatment of the Palestinians is simply unacceptable to large numbers of people. And my argument is that as time goes by, that will be more and more the case.
Okay. So now we'll get to some questions from the audience. Here are two related ones, I think. Your 2006 book largely attributed the U.S. decision to invade Iraq to the Israel lobby. But many of the neoconservative policymakers involved in that decision were not particularly loyal to Israel, including Donald Rumsfeld. What is the evidence that the lobby was the primary cause? And another question, to what extent would you say that the Israel lobby was responsible for the attacks on various Middle East countries such as Iraq?
Okay, with regard to the Iraq war, our basic argument was that, of course, George Bush and Vice President Cheney had to be in favor of the war and for it to happen, and that neither one of them is part of the Israel lobby. Our argument in the book, and of course in the article as well, is that the lobby was deeply interested in getting Iraq and taking Saddam Hussein down for a long time before the actual invasion on March 19th, 2003. And the lobby, and here we're talking especially about the neoconservatives, were pushing very hard for a war against Iraq. And in the wake of what looked like a stunning military victory in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, we came to the conclusion, falsely, of course, that we had the magic formula for taking down regimes and getting out of town quickly so that we could march on to the next target. This is what the Bush Doctrine was all about. So what you had in 2002 and early 2003 was a situation where we thought we could win a quick and easy victory in Iraq, point number one. And number two, you had this group of neoconservatives who were deeply committed to taking down Saddam Hussein, who had a huge amount of influence in the media and in the Bush administration, who pushed very hard. And therefore, we argue, they were the main driving force. But there's no question that they alone could not have made the war happen. They needed President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. And they all went along because they basically bought the neoconservative arguments, which were, of course, not simply couched in terms of doing something that was good for Israel, right? They bought the argument, and they thought that we could go in and win in quick and decisive victory. They were wrong. We jumped into a quagmire. And furthermore, they were wrong in the sense that we had not won a decisive victory in Afghanistan. We had won a temporary victory, and the Taliban eventually came back from the dead. So we had two huge disasters on our hand, which still exist today, one being Afghanistan, two being Iraq, and of course, as a result of the Iraq war, in part, Syria has turned into a disaster as well.
Okay, here's a question about your professional career. What has been the evolution or impact of your book and your principled, outspoken views on your career? Has your university been uniformly supportive of your academic freedom?
I think that there's no question that for both Steve at Harvard and for me at the University of Chicago, we've not been punished in any significant way. at either Harvard or at the University of Chicago, and both universities have fully supported our right to speak out on this issue and other issues. American universities are actually excellent when it comes to freedom of speech issues in almost all cases, not every case, but in almost all cases. And we were taken care of in that regard. Larry Summers was the president of Harvard at the time, and he defended Steve down the line, and the key officials at Chicago did the same with me. It's very hard to say exactly how much of an impact writing that book had on our professional lives. I would note that, just in my own case, I've written a number of other controversial pieces on controversial subjects that have gotten me into trouble. For example, I argue that with regard to the present crisis in U.S.-Russian relations, that we, the United States, are principally responsible for creating that crisis. The Ukraine crisis was not the result of Vladimir Putin's doings. It had to do with the fact that the West, and especially the United States, were very interested in making Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's doorstep. And the Russians long made it clear that that was unacceptable. And it was our policies that led to the crisis. Now, you can agree or disagree with that, but that view is a minority view, I can tell you. There are probably about five people in the United States who believe that. So there are a lot of people who are angry at me for that, right? And it's hard to tell how much of the trouble I have getting speaking engagements here and there or getting put on, you know, this board or that board is due to the fact that I wrote the Israel lobby or due to the fact that I have, you know, been controversial on other issues as well. But I think just in general, without going into any details, there are surely a number of opportunities that we were not afforded because we wrote the article and the book.
Well, I think we're out of time. I'm tempted to ask you more questions, but I think we're on a pretty tight schedule. So thank you so very much again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to University of Chicago Professor John Mearsheimer speaking at a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in April of 2017. Before we sign off this morning, we want you to know about the appearance of Miko Peled in Boston. Miko Peled is the author of The General's Son, an autobiographical journey of his family's transition from architect of the Israeli experiment. His late father was a prominent general in the formation of the State of Israel, to one of Israel's sharpest critics. Miko Peled will speak at the Community Church of Boston in Copley Square on August 28th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $20 ahead of time and $25 at the door and can be obtained online through brownpapertickets.com. That's brownpapertickets.com. Miko Peled, coming to Boston, August 28th, Community Church of Boston. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Network 23, not receiving. Intermittent loss.
Edison Carter to Network 23. Come on, guys, clear this link.
Network 23 to Edison Carter. The link is strong and clear. 2 minutes to airtime. Your controller is Garister.
Thank you, 23.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Babe Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We all rely on the National Health Service, but can we trust those in charge right now to leave it in a hale and hearty state for our elderly selves and future generations? A government leak this week reveals that private healthcare secretary Jeremy Hunt has secretly doubled the number of NHS properties up for sale, just as the Naylor report suggested. Is Oliver Letwin's plan to destroy the NHS before the next general election well underway in secret? Plus, how well does a culture of denial and cover-up sit around the Bristol United Hospital's NHS Trust executive and board? Local man Alan Condon's baby son Benjamin was admitted to Bristol's Children's Hospital with a suspected cold, but caught a superbug in there. It took the Trust 18 months and legal threats before they admitted they'd misled Alan and the rest of his family on several counts that tiny Benjamin had been given a drug which he shouldn't have been before he sadly died. Well, we invited a former master of the Merchant Venturers and also so-called independent chairman of the Trust, which has responsibility for ethics, John Savage, as well as any other trustees or members of the executive board on this show. But we're told by Abby Evans at UHB headquarters at the end of Jamaica Street that none of the 25 or so running the Trust was available. So what happens when you're paying their wages but you can't necessarily trust the Trust? Plus, another look at 9/11 from another scholar. This week is the turn of Jim Mars. He's the author of a book, Rule by Secrecy, amongst many others, who sadly died this week in Fort Worth, Texas, in our run-up to this year's 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Our sister show Dialects back again on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This week, Mark Pope lives in Marshfield and his father Ray's series of 1970s children's books about the little people living on model railways. They've become collector's items. Also, sham democracy, dictatorship and media mind control on a massive scale. Well, is it true or not? We hear about the conspiracy scholar Jim Mars, who passed away this week, from someone that knew him. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But before all that, I'm joined by former GP Charlotte Patterson and former mental health nurse and health policy academic Sue Kilroe. Hi and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Now, you're both part of this group, Protect Our NHS. You first, Charlotte. What's happening in the health service at the moment?
Well, the government's systematically destroying the health service at the moment. It's underfunding it very seriously, which I think most of us can begin to feel around us, as we can't get to GPs and we can't get our operations done. And it's also privatising it, which means it's breaking it up instead of being one good integrated service as it was designed to be. It's now little bits that are being sold off, as you said, buildings being sold off, but also contracted out services so that profit's being made out of it. Making profit out of people's illness is disgraceful.
But isn't that what pharmaceutical companies have been doing for years? They, in a way, there's a profit incentive on them. The more ill people, the more pills they need, the better. I mean, surely you must have come across that as a GP.
Well, just because they're doing it doesn't mean to say it's a good thing if the government starts doing it. It's bad whoever's doing it, trying to make money out of people's ill health. And we did have a system where taxpayers paid for their health service and all the money they paid went into the health service. Now half of it drains out into profits and into people's shareholding.
So where is that money going if it's not going towards patient care?
Well, a lot of it is going into into the private company's profits and therefore to the shareholders. So if they take on a contract, a private company will usually bid for the contract and get it because they're going to provide it cheaper. The only way they can do that is A, to cut the service or cut the staff pay and conditions, which they nearly always do. And the second thing they do then is to make enough money to take some out for themselves. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. There wouldn't be any point in it.
Now, as a retired GP, I'm sure you're still in touch with many other GPs, or some other GPs anyway. How have they noticed changes to the way that the health service is being run and the priorities that they have over the last, I suppose we're talking about 7 years really, since the Health and Social Care Act in the 2010 government came in?
Well, I think for them, the fracturing of the health service gives them an awful lot of extra work.
What does that mean?
Well, before, if they wanted, say, someone had a bad hip and you wanted to get a specialist to see them, you simply chose the consultant you thought was best and referred the person to the consultant. That doesn't happen anymore, so now you have to refer to a central referral system that will then decide where they're going to go. If they do get to see someone, they may or may not get the service that they thought they were going to get, and it's very, very slow, and the waiting lists are long. So all the time that the patient isn't getting what they want, they're constantly coming back to the GP. Understandably, it's the only place they can go. So the GP's work is increased as the health service becomes inefficient, the more work the GP has to do, and there's a lot of extra paperwork, of course.
It must be a bit peculiar for you as a retired GP to be actually almost like diagnosing the National Health Service as if it's your patient.
I don't diagnose it as if my patient. I wouldn't give the government that pleasure. The government's just destroying it in front of my eyes, and as a GP, as a lot of other people, I can't sit by and see it disappear. It's our health service. We're the ones that have got to fight for it.
Is there anything we can do?
There's lots we can do. The main thing is to start to take responsibility for getting together with other people and defending things when they're not working well. Not by attacking the doctors and nurses who, generally speaking, are just trying to do a good job, but by putting pressure on the government, our MPs, and locally maybe just making a big fuss if something's about to go. There have been examples of some hospitals in Essex that were going to be downgraded, and there was a huge public outcry, and people really just, you know, took it upon themselves to do something. And in the end, those plans were changed because the MPs got involved and it was all changed.
Well, I can remember 5 or 6 years ago in Stroud, there was a maternity hospital on some very valuable land that the lots of house builders would very much like to build on, and the local people there saved it because effectively everybody, well, most everybody, got involved. I mean, it's actually difficult to persuade people to take something out of their time to do this. But tell us about Protect Our NHS. What are you able to do in order to sort of bring people together? Are you able to actually focus effort a little bit?
Yeah, we're a group that meet every fortnight. We're quite a big group, and we've got all sorts of people, patients and previous health workers and health workers. And we do a lot of work out trying to involve other people. We do a lot of street stalls, for example. We go and talk when we get invitations. And then when there's a problem, for example, when Virgin Healthcare were trying to take over our community health services, we ran a big campaign that involved lots of people, and that was successful as well.
Just tell us about why you didn't want Virgin to do that. I mean, they're perfectly competent. Well, actually, some would say the trains don't always arrive on time. The flights don't always arrive on time. But, I mean, surely that, you know, there's no reason why a company like Virgin couldn't do a job like that just as effectively as anybody else.
Well, they're a big private company, so the reason they're doing it is to make a profit. That's the first thing. They're not doing it for the good of the nation. They're not public servants. So they run it. They will run it in order to make a profit. They will downgrade staff's pay and conditions. They will downgrade the amount of service that is provided. And by doing that, they've got some money left in the bank, and pigs' snouts get in the trough, and off the money goes.
Now, I'm also joined by Sue Kilroe. Sue, you're a former mental health nurse and also health policy academic, but almost the second part of your former job description that I find most fascinating, health policy. I mean, things aren't really going your way, I would imagine.
No, I feel that everything that I worked for all the way through my whole life, from when I enrolled as a student nurse in 1962 until now, has essentially been thrown in my face. and undermined. At this point, it is truly heartbreaking, and makes me, you know, either I'm going to sit down and cry and do nothing, or I'm going to fight. So I've chosen the fight route.
Is there anything we can do by fighting? Because ultimately, surely this is about money. I mean, there's lots of money going out of the National Health Service, as we've just heard, on other things like profits for private companies. One of the big ways that in which money is hemorrhaging out of the service is through the PFI deals and the interest payments on the PFI deals. For example, you get a wonderful, brand spanking new hospital. The only trouble is it's really not yours because it's owned by another company, a PFI deal company, and they're using the fact that you need it to make a profit, a bit like a rack-renting landlord. So, I mean, you worked in mental health as well. It must actually affect you. You're talking about sitting down and crying. It's very difficult to know how to deal with something like this.
It's so big. It's very difficult to find a way in to create somewhere where you can get leverage to help people to understand that they are right and they should be angry and they can do something about it.
So what can we do?
We can, like Charlotte said, is that we have to come together and we have to work with journalists like you who are prepared to create a public discussion so that people know what's happening.
So do you think that there isn't a proper public discussion about what's going on? I mean, we've heard right at the top of the hour, I was talking about this report this week where it's actually been leaked that the government is actually selling off twice as many hospitals as they had told us that they were.
Okay. So that information is not new. Maybe the exact number of properties that will be sold off, but the direction of travel of the selling off assets been established for over a year. That's information.
So it's a principle, but the headline's saying is it's quietly doubled just over the last few weeks, the number of NHS properties that it's selling off.
What would help us locally is if we could identify exactly which properties locally were on this list, and then people who live in the local area can develop a discussion about the value of that to them as health land, or the issue about housing and what sort of housing might happen in those space, and what the effect on the health service will be if the health service has got to sell off its property and then rent it back to use it to provide services.
Amazing.
Will be more PFI type tax.
Well, look at what's happened to Bristol General Hospital, of course. That has been sold off. It was actually, there was a load of wrangling for years about were they going to put any affordable housing in it. They finally said, no, we're not going to. And it's effectively been turned into luxury flats. Are we going to see the same with, King Edward VIII Hospital at the BRI, because that looks as if that may be being... I'm not sure what's happening with that.
Across the road from the opposite side of the road to the BRI.
Yeah.
And there's the Nuffield Hospital in Clifton, and there's the hospital at the back of Berkeley Square. That all of this was either, you know, it's been moved, not directly from NHS, but there's a lot of property around, and land is very expensive in Bristol, so we need people to come forward who know about property. One of the problems is if you get a group of retired, you know, a protest group that is very largely comprised of health and social care workers, we need people who have property and legal knowledge to work with us to be able to help with this campaign.
I think the other thing to say is that we don't need to be selling off and making more money. The government's got lots of money. We're the richest, one about the fifth richest country in the world. It's a question of where we put the money. And, you know, most countries in Europe spend much more on their health than we do. And the government simply needs to get out there and start spending again, as they have done. The last Labour government spent much more money than the
government. Well, what we hear constantly from Jeremy Hunt is that they're spending more and more on the health service all the time.
Well, of course they're spending more, because they've set up a structure that's very, very expensive to run.
It's absolutely loaded with chief executives, and they are all on super high salaries. The numbers of people who earn over £150,000 a year has rocketed in the NHS. And that's, you know, that that it doesn't go into frontline services. These are people who are managing the business process. They're not producing health.
Well, that's amazing because it almost parallels with the BBC. I can remember working there and feeling that if only we could get rid of all of these managers and all of the middle managers and all of the producers that have been taken off working on programmes because their programmes were so low rated, that actually we could just get on and make programmes. It would be a hell of a lot easier. The only people we really did want to keep were the engineers that actually kept the studios going. So it's a similar kind of thing, it seems, going on there. But I just want to reiterate that I did ask for the United Hospital Bristol's NHS Trust to come on this programme. So one of the 25 or so people running it, that's both on the executive board and on the actual trustees themselves, to come and talk about what's happening, to give us a balanced view. But it just seems to me pretty strange, Sue, that out of 25 of them being given a fair bit of notice to come on the radio, not one single one of them wants to come.
Well, there's a culture of silence imposed on health workers right through the NHS.
Well, hang on, because that's hopeless when it comes to safety, isn't it? If you're not allowed to talk about things, you can't actually talk about safety issues.
Well, we know that NHS England has done everything it can possibly do to deny junior doctors or doctors as a whole the right to be whistleblowers, and is fighting a hugely expensive case over a guy called Dr. Day. But that's at the formal end of the suppression of dialogue within. But on a day-to-day basis, you will find that NHS staff are very reluctant to engage with any member of the public about what's happening to the NHS. And that's because there's pressure on them, subtle bullying, all sorts of different ways in which, and they're frankly sometimes told, do not discuss politics.
Well, I mean, surely everybody has a right to, freedom of speech. What will happen to NHS employees if they do speak out?
Well, they can be blacklisted, and life can be made very difficult for people who step out of line within big institutions like the NHS, and that does happen to people. So if some people won't do it, then others won't. So the culture very, and then they end up, because they feel uncomfortable to talk to each other even about what's happening, they end up really as a workforce that doesn't know that much about what's happening.
Now, Charlotte, it doesn't sound like a very good culture, a culture of fear, to be the predominant culture in a hospital.
No, it's disgraceful, but it expands, as Sue said, it's not just in one hospital, it's going right through the system. And it's particularly important in the fact that we don't hear as the public what the plans are for our health service locally. We know, people who are in the know that the local NHS has got to save, in inverted commas, i.e. cut £200 million, £300 million, I think, out of the budget. But most people don't know that. Most people don't know what the plans are and how it's planned to do. So secrecy in day-to-day stuff, but also secrecy in these huge plans that are going to affect it. There's no consultation at the moment about them. There's no democracy at all.
Well, I'm also joined by, who's been sitting here very patiently, local man Alan Condon, whose son sadly died in the Bristol Children's Hospital. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Could you just give us an idea and take us through what happened in your case?
Ben developed a cold at home when he was 8 weeks old, and he was taken into hospital it said he had human metapneumovirus, which is very much like RSV.
Sorry, what's RSV?
it's just like a cold virus, which is very, very common with youngsters, especially under 5 years old, at a certain time of the year. So he was taken into Bristol Children's Hospital with this, and during that week we were informed that, he was getting worse, and they suspected this secondary bacterial infection that they would treat with antibiotics. And it went on and on
so
and
did
on.
He, did, I mean, did he actually get some sort of secondary infection in the hospital?
Yeah, he got something called Pseudomonas, which he caught in the hospital, but because it went untreated, it eventually ended up as sepsis. So he died of Pseudomonas sepsis, or sepsis syndrome from the Pseudomonas, because it was left untreated.
I think the most shocking thing, in a way, in your case, aside from your son dying, was just how difficult it was to find out what had actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing for us as well was that the hospital knew that Ben had developed a secondary infection several hours before he died, and they failed to tell us, they failed to put it in any medical note, and also they convinced us that a post-mortem wasn't necessary, and then in a meeting 7 weeks after Ben had died was the first time that they told us that he developed this secondary infection. However, then they told us that it could have only been on the last day, because they'd done blood tests that were negative the day before, and we later found out that them tests were never taken, so there was never, you know, there was the negative. Them saying there was a test done was a lie, but also that the fact that there was a negative result. And it took us 12 months to find out that actually they knew about it prior to Ben dying. They made this claim that they only discovered the infection after he died.
So how did you feel you were treated as a family?
The first thing is when your child dies, you don't know what the process is. You just sort of go along. You know, you sort of put into a channel.
I mean,
like.
I mean, if there's any doubt whatsoever, surely you know there should be some kind of an inquest.
Well, we had an inquest 18 months later, and you know, during that 18 months, the hospital finally, you know, they tripped themselves up on several occasions, and we discovered that he had that. You know, they admitted to us that not only did he have this infection, but had they treated it earlier, then it would have given him a much better chance of treating him.
That's a terribly long time to wait for an inquest, isn't it? I mean, that's 18 months, I suppose, you're having to wait and, to a certain extent, fight to get that inquest.
It is, and also as well, it's during that period of time, they kept tripping themselves up and up. But the biggest thing for us was when we finally got to the inquest, and we thought that, you know, that would be where the truth eventually came out properly. They then backtracked on everything that they'd said, and told a different story at the inquest, and convinced the coroner that he didn't have an infection. The infection didn't cause him to die, and that had they treated it, it would have made no difference.
And what do you think of that?
The whole thing's absolutely shambolic. I mean, from start to finish, I mean, from 5-6 hours before Ben died, we believed that they were well and truly aware that he was going to die, and that they'd done everything they possibly could to cover his death up.
The specific individuals that are involved here, it would have been nice to at least make some of these general, I mean, we're not so interested in that, but some of these general points. If the chairman of the trust, who's in charge of ethics, John Savage, was sitting around this table as we asked him to be, and he decided that he couldn't make it, or none of his colleagues could make it, what would you say to him?
I think the thing is that we've never had the answers to the basic questions. The trust are very, very good at providing, you know, overarching documents, 40-page documents, and then posting on there the trust to say that, you know, they've done everything they can to answer questions. However, that they don't have the ability to not answer. You know, they have the ability to avoid the very simple questions, you know, the ones about the lies at the inquest or the lies in the meetings, and they just railroad you down a certain track, you know, where they claim that they've done everything they can to help you, when actually all they're doing is just covering their own backs.
Why have they done that, do you think?
I believe that they became aware that they'd made a mistake with Ben before he died. They were very complacent about the illness he had. I mean, they told us 3 days before he died that Ben is of no concern to us. We have children on the ward who are seriously ill and can die, which pretty much summed up the treatment and the care they give to Ben compared to the other children on the ward. And I think that on the last day, they then realised that he'd severely deteriorated and that they'd got it wrong. And they just wasn't willing to accept them failings. And then once the lies started, I think it just created this huge snowball effect.
Well, it's easy to, in hindsight, but do you now wish you'd never taken Ben to hospital or even to a doctor or anything?
I think ultimately you've got to have faith. You've got to have faith in the NHS. You know, whether you go to your GP, to the hospital, to you know, I think if we say we're not going to take them, you know, then as a parent, then we're putting our children at risk. You know, we've got to have the faith that. But you know, we've made a conscious decision now that we certainly wouldn't go back to Bristol Children's Hospital.
Now, I came across you actually walking up and down the pavement outside the BRI. I don't imagine that you're allowed to distribute the leaflet that you were inside the BRI, in the coffee shop or whatever, which would be an interesting place to try and do it. You've got your leaflet, it says NHS Child Death Cover-Up, Bristol Children's Hospital, and there's a picture of your son here. You have obviously decided that you haven't really had any kind of justice through the processes you've already been through.
We've decided that we've had enough of their processes. So, you know, they're railroading, and, you know, they put you into a little spiral and spin you around until you drop out the bottom and go away. So we've decided...
Just tell me about those processes. What processes are they?
Well, they'll never answer the question. You know, they'll always say, we'll come back to you. You know, you go to a meeting and they'll have 30, 40 days following that meeting to create the answers. The child death review, you know, they provide you a report, and if you challenge it, you know, there's another 2 months following that. And it just got to the point where we realised that the one key point for us was there was a clear inconsistency between what a doctor had told us in a meeting and what was said at the inquest. And they got a professor to investigate it, and the professor's answer was that there was no inconsistency. And it was clear to everyone to see that there was. And for us, that was the real key turning point for us to realise that actually they wasn't interested in helping us. What they were doing was they were interested in making sure that they came out looking good.
It does sound like they may have been just employing somebody to tell them what they wanted to hear and paying them public money too.
Well, I think one of the things which stands out for us is that they're very, very good with the media side of things, and very good at making themselves sound very, very good in the process. You know, they offer a small apology for something that's not significant or not relevant, but will avoid all the relevant, you know, the relevant matters within the case.
So what have they done with you now? Because you're distributing these leaflets, as you should be, have every right to, I suppose, outside the hospital, taking your time out. Was it once a week or how often?
I do 2 hours. 2 hours every day through the week, and I stand out. You know, I stand at the high footfall area by the hospital, by the trust and the main entrance, and I've give them out. And you know, I'm getting lots of feedback from staff who work at the hospital that there's a lot of outrage from staff in the hospital that nothing's getting done about this, and that this person's standing there every day handing out these leaflets. Some of the staff are taking it quite personally, but ultimately the names and faces of the people that are in there, they've done wrong and they've covered up a child's death, and somebody needs to be held accountable for it.
So are they pursuing you or whatever in some way? I don't imagine that they particularly want you standing out there distributing information about what happened to your son.
No, they don't, but every single word that's in there is factual information. There is a couple of the individuals who've took the opportunity to pursue me legally, but the trust in general are very much staying away from the matter and allowing it to happen, but I'm not so sure that there's anything that they can do to stop me.
It doesn't sound like going back to our retired health professionals from Protect Our NHS doesn't sound...
It rings bells.
Does it?
The sort of dilemmas that we're facing all of the time is there's a lot of concern growing in the Bristol area about the services, infertility services. At Southmead Hospital, we had one of the best functioning fertility services units in the country with very, very good results. And the Southmead Hospital Trust undertook to build them as their own special building, and it's got laboratories and all of the freezer equipment and everything in that's needed. But because of the NHS cuts, one way or another, the service is being withdrawn from the NHS. It's no longer going to be provided there. And there's a decision was made that the demand for the service was falling, and therefore that there was no further need for that contract to be fulfilled. And we've been trying to find the information, the evidence that that decision was based on, and we can't get anyone to come forward and show us where the evidence is, how they analysed, who criticised and did the analysis of what figures that allowed them to make this decision to withdraw this service. There will be an infertility service, but maybe people will have to go to somewhere like Birmingham And ultimately, the space that's created by the withdrawal of the NHS unit is to be filled by private for-profit fertility service companies. And one of those companies is to be headed up by the consultant that had previously run the NHS.
That seems to have happened quite a lot, doesn't it, with former people involved in professional roles. So it's happened a lot in social work as well,
well, yes,
where they've set up their own businesses and they're now... Is this
a conflict of interest or not?
Well, it is, obviously. Anyway, Charlotte, I wonder if that story Alan's just told us rings any bells with you. I feel a bit guilty in a way. I mean, we're almost like a kind of court of appeal here, where one side has not bothered to turn up in court, you know, because surely what Alan's saying here is, and in a way explaining to all of us, is that the systems of checks and balances within the NHS right now just don't seem to be working.
Well, I think it's a heartbreaking story, obviously, but yeah. I think it's also an example of what happens when you lose democracy in something like our National Health Service. It was set up to have a lot of local democracy with the community health councils and so on. And once we start to lose that and trusts then become more like big business, then we start to lose this human side and this democracy side and this ethical side. And then we end up with this, that's not just words, is it? Then we end up with the story that we've just heard. So I think it shows when we use these big words like democracy and so on, what we're really meaning is that people like Alan end up with this story. And how can someone try and get over that? So, yeah.
What were the community health councils? I mean, these were some sort of way in which that people could make kind of formal complaints about the National Health Service in the old days, were they?
They were very much part of the structure of the NHS when it was set up. Yeah, and they were a way of the community being connected to their local hospitals and
providers,
GPs. Because it wasn't then split up in the way it is now, you know, between providers and whatever all the words they have. It was just a locality where you had, you know, health service workers trying to provide a service for the community that they were in. That's what it was, our health service. And the community council was the link between the community they were in and the people trying to provide the service.
But I mean, surely, you know, with those, still you're going to find doctors, consultants, even GPs, etc., I suppose, trying to cover up if they've done something wrong. No one, you know, it's a natural thing in human beings that we don't want to necessarily admit we've done something wrong, do we?
Well, it's part of professional ethics that you don't do that. But, of course, there will always be people who do. The thing is that we have to have good structures in place that are ethical and democratic so that people who've got concerns can have them properly heard.
If you don't have some sort of mechanism for sitting down and looking at what happens in an untoward episode, then you don't learn and how to stop it happening again. So that it, you know, the silencing and covering things up just contributes to a downward spiral of the quality of the service as a whole.
I mean, all you really learn is how to cover it up better the next time.
Yeah.
Which is rather worrying. The other thing is, you know, it would have been lovely to have John Savage here, who, of course, was actually up until a few years ago a member of the Labour Party, but he dropped out when Jeremy Corbyn took over. But he calls himself an independent chair of the UHB NHS Trust. But, of course, for anyone that looks into his background, you'll find that he was in charge of Business West, which is, of course, a bit of a very powerful networking group, which is very good at getting large amounts of taxpayers' money for big business in the region, and also a former master of the Merchant Venturers. You know, these are the people who were involved in financing John Cabot's discovery of America, even though, of course, quite a few 100 million or so Native Americans had already discovered it, and also, of course, in the slave trade. But great pity that John can't be here. What do you make of this sort of the reluctance to actually come on and discuss these things? You first, Sue.
Okay. Well, the NHS is like society as a whole, and there is a sort of group of people in the city that you would call the establishment. And both North Bristol Trust and UBT is managed and run by people who are members of the establishment. So that's big. There's very strong connection between big business and the public services. And we have this at a local level, an example of which of something that's called the revolving door syndrome, where that people move from business into public services and back into business again. And you know, Simon Stevens, who's the head of NHS England, is the most high-profile and threatening person to the NHS, who has revolved from the NHS to business in the head of the biggest insurance business, in health insurance business in America, and back to the UK to actually be the civil servant in charge of the NHS. So that we have local versions. So I think that Savage is very much like that at a local level. The mystery really is how he was ever a member of the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, it does seem interesting.
Rather than the fact he isn't anymore.
How do people like this, who seem to be so very close to big business, get put into positions like that?
They're spending
half £1 billion, roughly, that's the budget of UHB Trust, of our money every year on what's supposed to be a public service. Mm. But they seem to be actually maybe closer to big business than they are to public service.
Well, I'm very happy, you know, through my life for all of that money to be spent on health services whose primary purpose is to create health in the population, to address the health needs and to meet those needs, and to have as their primary aim the creation of health and well-being. But because business interests are sanctioned by the government as the primary purpose of our health services now, that and the loading of all of the bodies that manage our health services with business expertise, business people, primary purpose is profit. It's so that the subcontracting of services out of the public service for the NHS to companies is very comfortable process for people who are from the business community. And they believe that they can do it better than anybody else. They can't. You know, the evidence, universal evidence is that publicly owned health services are more effective, more efficient, and the people who live in those countries there's a sort of greater degree of equality between the rich and the poor, and there's better health.
Sounds to me like this is a culture which is coming from the top down, John Savage, so get your finger out, come on this programme and face some of your critics rather than running and hiding away. Just before we finish, I'd just like to ask all of you how you think things could be improved, because we know, I think, that it's not working. We know that there is effectively a massive sabotage of our future health going on around the country, not just here in Bristol. But with you, Charlotte, we can't get appointments with our GPs at the moment. So what can we do? Is anything... You know, in fact, it's quite difficult. You can get appointments with your GPs, but it's getting more and more and more difficult. What can we do to sort it out?
Well, on a bigger scale, there is a plan that is well thought through and would take our health service back much more to how it was originally, and that's called the NHS Bill. There's a bill that's been trying to get before Parliament, and that contains a lot of detail, but it's basically getting rid of this marketisation, getting rid of the private companies and making it a proper public service again. So one thing we can all do is to promote the NHS Bill, and we can find that on the internet quite easily and talk to our MPs and so on. The other more local thing is that there's going to be a big march in Bristol on July the 9th, which is against... which is against particularly the council cuts, which of course affect health hugely through social care, but it'll be against cuts generally. And that's a place one can get out on the street and just make our feelings felt. So keep September the 9th in your diary.
And don't underestimate the fun of actually getting out on the street with other people who feel the same, because you just get a sense that this isn't just about something that you read in the newspaper. This is actually about a mass movement that's decided that they're not going to do this to our National Health Service, probably the most amazing thing that Britain has ever produced. Anyway, what about you, Sue, how to fix it?
Yes, well, what we... we absolutely have to pull the NHS back from the profit motive. I think we've got to do everything that makes that possible. And we need everybody, you know, that small groups protesting, and even if they're doing really good work at all sorts of levels, will never have the same effect as a mass movement.
Well, Protect Our NHS is a good place to start. Where do we find you? Either physically in a room or on the internet. I'll put a link up on our show page as well.
We can provide you with that information, but we meet on the first and third Tuesday of every month. And currently we're using a room in Tony Benn House to do that. We have all sorts of subgroups that work on different issues, and we need loads of people.
Well, I'll just make sure the contact details are on the show page at thisweek.org.uk.
We have a very active Facebook page where we'd love people to be able to, you know, comment on what we put there and put in their own experiences on there, and that tells people what's going on, as well as a website.
We need people to share their stories about what's happening to them, like your family story.
Like
it's
Alan,
really important that these stories are shared.
Alan, nothing's going to bring your son back, but I really admire what you're doing, because I think you said to me when we were, this isn't about me, this is about making sure this doesn't happen to other people in the future. It's a wonderful sentiment. Thank you so much. So how do we fix it?
I think there's two things, really. For the first one is honesty with families in this situation. You've got to remember we're talking about a child's life. We're not talking about, you know, it's not just a product or something. You know, this is someone's life, and actually what they're doing is they're destroying families. You know, they're destroying our family, they're destroying other families with what they're doing. One of the things that we're now in the process of doing along with the leaflets is we've set up a petition to challenge Jeremy Hunt on the law around what these consultants and senior managers actually from Bristol Hospital have been allowed to get away with. So we've set that up online, and we've had a great response from it. Within the first couple of weeks, we got just coming up to 2,000 signatures, which we have a long way to go. But I genuinely believe that people supporting something like that is going to put more and more pressure on. But we're not alone in the issue with Bristol Hospital. You know, there's several families which I'm aware of that are going through the same processes from 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But I think ultimately they just need to start being honest with people and looking at the mistakes, because they're never going to learn from the mistakes if they don't accept them, and they're never going to move on from them and be better in future.
Well, one thing you need to do, John Savage, is make sure you don't bully and sack your employees if they speak out and if they say what they feel to some of the patients. So thank you very much. That was a retired GP, Charlotte Patterson, and also retired mental health nurse and health policy academic, Sue Kilrow, and also Alan Condon, who can be found on the email of Benjamin Condon, CONDON, at outlook.com. Thanks very much, all of you, for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to have a listen now to a bit of Donald Trump, I'm afraid, because he has been speaking out about North Korea. And we're going to go, I think this is an NBC report about what he's been saying about North Korea.
The alarming warning tonight from a U.S. official briefed on the Defense Intelligence Agency assessment, telling NBC News Kim Jong-un has now constructed a miniature nuclear warhead small enough to fit inside one of its new long-range missiles, a missile that could reach the U.S. mainland. A major line crossed. The dictator has before shown off what he claims to be a miniaturized nuclear weapon. Now he may have built one.
The problem is he's beginning to perfect all of the elements of the ability to deliver a nuclear device to the homeland.
The speed of the regime's nuclear progress is stunning. U.S. intelligence thought it would take years to get this far. But just 11 days ago, North Korea launched a missile test that could reach all the way to Chicago.
The underestimation of the pace of this program, it represents a real blind spot as well as a danger for the United States.
There are still big hurdles for North Korea, crafting a warhead that can survive re-entry into the atmosphere and testing its accuracy to hit a target.
Ignition.
While this is just one intelligence assessment, the fear is North Korea is on track to solve the technical challenges sooner rather than later.
The North Koreans, if they proceed on their nuclear program, will figure out how to miniaturize the nuclear device, which they have shown that they know how to detonate, miniaturize it and put it on top of an ICBM.
Now, that was really notable, Martin, for that report, for starting off by saying on NBC the North Koreans have miniaturized their nuclear weapons, blah, 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 big announcement. And then by the end of the report, they're saying, well, they might be doing it sometime in the future.
Yes, I mean, there's an awful lot of disinformation and hysteria going on. I mean, it's pretty clear that the North Koreans have developed viable nuclear weapons, although whether they've developed ballistic missiles that can deliver them to the US is debatable. They can probably deliver them to Japan, which is much nearer, and Japan, of course, is the traditional enemy of Korea. They were the occupying power in Korea from 1905
to
1945.
Okay, so let's just have a listen now to what Donald Trump actually said.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Well, fascinating comments from Trump, but even more fascinating is what the people who live on Guam, 100,000 of them, think about all this, which we've heard hardly anything of. Well done, BBC, for yesterday getting a Chamorros doctor, he's Michael Bavanka, from the University of Guam on to talk about what they make of this latest saber-rattling.
For the past few years, there has been regular threats made by North Korea as they've been testing their missiles. Frequently, they'll mention that they can target Guam, that they could hit Guam. This was sort of the most specific and pronounced threat to the island. But what really sort of pushed it to a new level of anxiety here was Donald Trump's response. Is his aggressive rhetoric. Usually we get that just from the North Korean side, and the U.S. response is much more measured. And so that's really what made things a little bit more anxiety-ridden today, was just the fact that on both sides of us, we had these people using very aggressive language, pointing weapons at each other. And the people of Guam, we just could not help but feel kind of caught in the middle of this war of words, which could easily become a war involving real weapons. Guam is a beautiful island. It's only about 212 square miles. Imagine that one-third of that is U.S. military facilities with bombers and fighters landing all the time, miles and miles of military fencing, aircraft carriers and nuclear submarines visiting regularly. And so Guam lives a very militarized existence, which is why these sorts of threats are common. Just last year, the Chinese government announced that they had developed a missile which they named in honor of Guam. It was called the Guam Killer, because now they said that they could reliably target Guam with their missiles. And so this is the kind of reality for us. The United States itself has called us the tip of their spear.
The tip of their spear. This is not the most helpful language, but Martin, this is seems as if this is another potential conflict zone. We were talking about the start of World War III, another little plank that's spinning. But the main problem with Korea is that it doesn't seem like the American government, or certainly Donald Trump, cares any more about a North Korean life than he does about a South Korean life.
Well, I mean, the rhetoric is way, way out of line. Trump's put himself in an impossible position where he's basically threatened to nuke North Korea or to carry out an attack on them, which is exactly will lead to the nuclear war that everybody claims they don't want. And the fact of the matter is, if a state has nuclear weapons, just as Pakistan developed nuclear weapons in the 1990s, the Israelis developed them in the 1980s and 1970s, neither of them are supposed to have them. But once they've got them, then there's not a lot you can do.
Finally, a bit of I haven't heard this on the mainstream news at all. This is from the Donetsk People's Republic's news service. Greatly, I'll put a link to that on our show page. The United States has urged its citizens to leave North Korea before the 1st of September.
Well, that's because they're potentially planning. McMaster has said we could go to war, we could have a preemptive war on North Korea. Although somebody else pointed out, you can't preempt something that's already happened. You can't have a preemptive war to stop nuclear weapons being developed by the North Koreans. They've already got them. And at that point, you just have to back off. You can't force them to give up nuclear weapons. From their point of view, it's absolutely logical. It's the reason that Britain claims to have nuclear weapons. We're not going to use them. We're just going to use them if someone uses them on us.
We haven't got time for Jim Mars, unfortunately. Maybe we can do that next week. But we can hear something from him anyway about him on Tuesday's Dialect. But there is the potential, of course, you know, everyone, really, many, many people out there talking about the 9/11 attacks as a false flag with some kind of inside job, maybe even a nuclear false flag in North Korea.
Well, something like that may happen. The North Koreans are easy patsies for this, because if somebody, you know, if for example, a ship is sunk, and they say the North Koreans have sunk the ship, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which began the Vietnam War, because North Korea has got such bad credibility, it's the sort of thing that people might believe, and then they say, all right, this is justification to have a war with them. But the fact
if you wanted a war with North Korea, would you sanction a false flag nuclear attack?
Well, you might if you were the sort of person that wants a war with North Korea. The problem is...
nobody wants a war like this, do they?
Oh, you just don't know, do you? The problem with this, I don't think anybody wants a war on the North Korean side, the South Korean side, and let's not forget that they've got some views about all of this. And of course, they've had military dictatorships in South Korea. They haven't got one at the minute, but in the past they have brutal military dictatorships. And the idea that North Korea are the bad guys and South Korea are the good guys, to some extent true, but to some extent not true.
So it's okay. Nobody really wants a war, do they?
Nobody really wants the First World War, but one shot by Gavril Princip led to a war, and especially when you've got people shouting their mouths off like Trump and the North Korean leadership, the possibility of a war is definitely
there. And
you've also
got people making money out of war, folks. So Putin has stayed well out of the fray, braving the cold waters as he strips down to the waist in Siberia on a fishing holiday. Apparently now he's nipped down to Abkhazia as well, looking at the Black Sea. But the US is building a base in the Black Sea, a new base in Ukraine.
Yes, that's right. I mean, what's interesting this week is that the Chinese and the Russians have supported a sanctions policy in the UN Security Council. It's about time that the Americans started cooperating with others instead of just acting unilaterally.
Amen to that. Okay, so time to sign off for the news, Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Bakawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Brislington West, Harriet Bradley. Also to retired GP, Charlotte Patterson, and former mental health nurse, health policy academic, Sue Kilrow from Protect Our NHS, as well as Alan Condon. I'll put links to Alan's campaign as well on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialect remembers the life of Texas conspiracy scholar Jim Mars next Tuesday at noon. Catch it online now if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. This show's story links and comment page is thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1996, Shaft Benjamin and Amanda Shaw. Do please join us for the Politics Show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Jaja is pulling off the pressure now. Of truth.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we look at the American deep state in the Trump era. We're joined by two scholars who have spent a long part of their career looking at the deep state and America's secret government. We're joined by Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we take a timely look at an historic topic that's been overlooked far too often, certainly by corporate media, but also by many scholars and others, even on the left of the spectrum. We're looking at the deep state, and today's guests are experts about deep state affairs and issues, and they are, of course, returning guests to the Project Censored Show. Peter Dale Scott is a former Canadian diplomat and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a leading political analyst and poet. His books include Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Drugs, Oil, and War, The United States and Afghanistan, Colombia, and Indochina, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. He's been awarded the Land and Poetry Award. His website can be found at peterdalescott.net. Peter Dale Scott, welcome back to Project Censored.
Good to see you again, Mickey.
And also we're joined by David Talbot. David Talbot is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller, Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He was the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon.com and was a senior editor at Mother Jones Magazine and the features editor of the San Francisco Examiner. He's written for The New Yorker, The Rolling Stone, Time, The Guardian, and other major publications. And most recently, he is a thrice-weekly columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle. His most recent book is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Good to be here.
So, Peter Dale Scott, let's begin with you. The issue of the deep state has been all over the corporate media and is infiltrated political discourse of late, certainly since the election of Donald Trump, or the electored presidency of Donald Trump, perhaps more accurately put. Can you start out by explaining to us, given your long roots and scholarship in the deep state, can you give our listeners a brief overview of sort of the historic trajectory of what you see as this deep state
If I could begin with what they're saying now, and then I will say sure. why I think that the term is being directed away from where it should really be. You know, the Trump campaign ran against Washington, promised to drain the swamp, and some of his supporters, starting back in August, started talking about the deep state and how Trump was going to clean it up. And recently, with all these leaks, particularly with the resignation of Flynn, Michael Flynn, with the National Security Advisor, a top appointment, and he lasted 24 days. This is really quite a startling event. And both sides in this conflict between Trump and Washington tried to spin that as an affair of the deep state, the Trump people attacking the deep state. And then you had three very similar stories coming out in traditional CIA outlets, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the L.A. Times. The L.A. Times piece was by Doyle McManus, who's carried water for the CIA before when the CIA wanted to destroy the reputation of Gary Webb, who had revealed about drugs in the Contras. Doyle McManus was in charge of a 17-man team at the L.A. Times. They were called the Get Gary Webb Team in-house. And they, too, are talking about the deep state, but they're trying to shrink the deep state down. So it's a way of talking about what I call the Beltway agencies, NSA, CIA, and the companies that they outsource to, like SAIC and Booz Allen Hamilton. In my own book, The American Deep State, that's an important part of the deep state, but certainly doesn't begin to get the full measure of this nexus, very amorphous and fluid and always changing power, what T. Wright Mills called a power elite. But I think that I would distinguish what I'm saying from his. First of all, I say that the deep state is not a structure. That's a mistake that many people make, I think. There was one article recently by a man called Edward Curtin. I liked his conclusion, but he was talking about the deep state got together and planned an attack. No, that's not possible. You're talking about something as huge as a weather system, as amorphous as a weather system, and potentially as dangerous as a weather system. It's more like a process than an actual structure. And, you know, seeing I brought up C. Wright Mills, I would just say that C. Wright Mills tended to stress the unity of interests in the power elite, and that's what gave him their power. I see the deep state as really much more conflicted than that. There are contending forces. You have old wealth, new wealth, corporate wealth, personal wealth. And back in the time of the Kennedy assassination, there was talk about the Yankees and the Cowboys and how the Sun Belt was different from Wall Street. All of these different ways of slicing it are true and different and balance each other out to some extent. America is very, very diverse, was at the beginning, coalition of slave states and non-slave states, which began the country with huge problems of racism that we're still trying to deal with. I think we're slowly making some progress there. So I would say that you think of the power elite and then think of something that's not structured, not unified, but is power behind the scenes. And you can quote any number of presidents who have acknowledged that they're just the president in the White House and there are other powers. That's the problem of getting a constitution that limits power. Right now, I'm very glad we have a constitution that limits power because it may steer us through what otherwise could be a very, very ugly period of American history. But if you're limiting public power with a constitution, then you get a legacy of private power that is not so limited. There are no constitutional rules for private power. And, you know, I think the historic role of progressives is to try and create rules that limit the amount of money that corporations can give to a political campaign, things like that. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of those rules being broken and thrown away recently, and that's part of our current crisis. David, would you agree with that?
Yeah, David Talbot, chime in here, please.
Well, I certainly agree that there's been a shrinking of the definition of the deep state in the current media hullabaloo about all this. And that's for good reason. The corporate media is part of the deep state. It doesn't want to include itself. It's something else. It's something limited. It's the CIA, the NSA, as Peter said, and that's about it. But no, it's much broader. And you're right. C. Wright Mills, who was the great, I think, scholar of the deep state during the Cold War period, the Columbia University sociologist, in his, I think, landmark book, The Power Elite, that Peter referenced earlier, defines it much more broadly and includes Wall Street. It includes key industries like the oil industry. It includes the corporate media. It's not just a few national security types in Washington. Now, what he did say was that in that period, there was a key sector of the power elite, and that was these men, and they were virtually all men in those days, who shuttled between Washington and Wall Street, like Alan Dulles, who I focus on in my book, The Devil's Chessboard, and others. And these were kind of the glue that held together sort of the ruling circles. They popped up in the same social clubs. They sent their kids to the same elite prep schools, and they were a very coordinated group. And you don't have, I think, in those days, quite as much of the factionalism as you have today within these ruling circles. And I think what we're seeing now is the struggle for the Trump administration, not just against the Trump administration, not just the backlash from the national security state, which we're obviously seeing, but also even this internal struggle within the Trump administration to define it and which one of these groups is going to control it. Michael Clare, who's been a frequent guest on Pacifica Radio as well, scholar in Hampshire College. He just wrote a piece recently for The Nation magazine defining these factions as the billionaires versus the bombardiers. So you have the sort of more traditional corporate and finance people who are obviously represented within the Trump administration. And then you have these ideologues, these new ideologues who are against global treaties, who are against internationalism, are much more nationalistic and extremist in those views, Steve Bannon and so on, versus the Rex Tillersons. Those two men, I think, are the emblematic figures in some ways in this new emerging Trump administration, Steve Bannon, the extremist nationalist, who comes out of Wall Street, ironically, himself. He worked at Goldman Sachs. But he was, I think, always a maverick figure there. And Rex Tillerson, the former head of Exxon, who, of course, has an internationalist perspective because Exxon is built on that and wants good relations with Russia and Putin for commercial reasons, not just ideological ones, perhaps. So I think there, it's a very interesting struggle that's going on right now. As a scholar, a journalist, you can sit back and sort of marvel at this. But unfortunately, as a citizen of the United States, there's some frightening implications because the country is up for grabs. I think the Russian hysteria, the hysteria about a so-called Russia hack of our democracy, which I think is incredibly over-exaggerated and overplayed by the media, has taken over, really, the debate within the Democratic Party and in the media. And I think in doing that and trying to use that as a way to, you know, destabilize Trump and even perhaps drive him out of office, the Democrats have become a one-issue party. And that wing of our ruling elite is deserting the American people in many ways by overly focusing on Russia and not focusing on the issues that are so urgently important to us, the healthcare system, which is now being perhaps overhauled and demolished by Republican ideologues like Paul Ryan, immigration, the EPA and every major agency and department in the government being taken over by critics of those agencies, by corporate lobbyists who are out to destroy. That's the ban on lying.
Yeah.
That's right. Anyway, so I just think, just to wrap up, that that is the real issue that we should be focusing on, and not this, in some ways, red herring of Russia. The Democrats and liberals, of all people, have revived the old Cold War Red Scare campaign in a desperate effort to attack Trump and put him on the defensive, and I think it really is playing with fire.
What has really distressed me, that a lot of quite intelligent intellectuals, both in the New York Review and in, most recently in the New Yorker, are part of this campaign that you're talking about, David. There was a very long article about Trump and Russia in the New Yorker. There were some good things in the article. It wasn't by idiots foaming at the mouth, But I was very disturbed to see the undercutting tone was almost a fear that the Trump administration is not going to be bellicose enough, and lamenting that one heroine in the article, this woman Evelyn Farkas, who had resigned from the Pentagon because Obama wasn't activist enough and she joined Hillary's campaign, they want Hillary without Hillary, and it's hard to look for good things that have happened recently. But Hillary wanted a no-fly zone in Syria. That would have meant confrontation with Russia and the possibility of a war. And what's happened instead is that it's clear that Russia and Turkey and America are sitting down together what to do. And the result is there's a focus on getting ISIS out of Raqqa, and America's going to put 400 troops into Syria, and you don't hear any objections from Russia. You also, what you don't hear, and certainly it was not what being emphasized, is that Trump, by doing this kind of focus on ISIS, seems to be quietly forgetting about the old Obama campaign to get rid of Assad, which Hillary would definitely have wanted to do. And everyone's talking about how dangerous Trump is, but there are a lot of different dangers, and I think one of the worst dangers in the last campaign would have been that we would have had Hillary, who would have proceeded with a very aggressive campaign in Ukraine and, above all, a very aggressive campaign in Syria. This is where I think it's helpful to come back and think about the deep state, because like you said, David, the deep state is represented inside the Trump administration. And there are, as Jane Mayer wrote about in Dark Money, a very, very good book, by the way, very good book. She was talking about all these people who line up with the Koch brothers to put money behind the Tea Party and essentially not so much capture the Republican Party as destroy the Republican Party, and have pretty much destroyed the Democratic Party, too, in the same process, also very polarized. Well, what she did say, something I think is very important, is that although a lot of these people aligned with the Tea Party and the Kochs, they represent new money, personal money, not corporate money, but also they are the heirs to the old America First faction that was in the Goldwater movement. The difference is that when the Goldwater people were around when Mills wrote The Power Elite, but they were very marginal, very, very marginal, and they are not marginal now. There's huge money behind them. And because it's personal money, they can do things corporations can't. The Kochs, for example, they're worth something like $80 billion. If they put $1 billion into politics to get an improved tax rate on their income, they get a very good return on that investment. And that's a huge investment to corrupt the political system. And that is the real problem we have. We have great disparity of wealth now, and a lot of that wealth is trying to trash the traditional government of this country because it's trying to put restraints on them and their wealth that they don't want.
That's the voice of Peter Dale Scott, author of The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. We're also joined by David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'll return to this program after a brief musical break and continue our conversation about the American Deep State. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're joined today by scholar Peter Dale Scott, author of numerous works on American politics and the deep state. One of his more recent books is The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy from 2015. We're also joined by author and journalist David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. You can also see David Talbot's columns three times a week at the San Francisco Chronicle. David Talbot, let's go to you. You've been writing about many of these things in the Chronicle, actually, of late, which is fantastic because we're getting some different perspectives than we're used to seeing in that outlet. And, of course, you had a conversation with Peter Dale Scott some weeks back about deep state issues and the Trump administration. But I wanted to riff momentarily on something that you brought up earlier, the infatuation of the Democratic Party and the corporate news media attacking Trump and Putin. And it's not just the Democratic Party. Like we saw earlier in the primaries last year, and then through the candidacy of Trump and the nomination of Donald Trump, there's definitely unrest in the Republican Party. Particularly, you write in one of your articles not long ago, the hubbub for a coup on the left and right, growing louder by the day. And you note that William Kristol, neoconservative anti-Trump position, is among those who has tweeted his secret longing to be saved by Big Brother. And you write, quoting him, saying, obviously strongly prefer normal democratic and constitutional politics, but if it comes to it, prefer the deep state to the Trump state. Unpack that for us momentarily. What are you saying that Kristol is saying about the deep state and Trump in that regard?
It's that he feels so marginalized, he and the neoconservative sort of wing of the Republican Party by the Trump administration, that he's prepared to go as far as sanctioning an overthrow of the democratically elected government of the United States. It's a cynical and cavalier attitude that unfortunately is shared widely within the political and media elites, not just on the right, on the left too. You have James Wolcott, the longtime columnist for the Vanity Fair, also in his kind of snarky way, suggesting that he too would support such a coup and attacking what he calls the alt-left, people like me, I suppose, for criticizing the view that we should have a new Cold War, a new Red Scare.
Strange left support for CIA coup or these types
exactly.
of activities.
It's an unholy alliance between the left and the right supporting this kind of deep state activity. Look, all we need to remind ourselves of as progressives is the incredible human damage and tragedy that has resulted around the world when the CIA does take actions against democracies. You know, going back in the Cold War era, which I write about in The Devil's Chessboard, in Iran, the overthrow of the democratic government there, Guatemala, and on through Chile and Allende, up to Honduras during the Obama administration. These are all terrible events that result in years of suffering. They tend to leach into the future for many years where democratic governments are replaced by authoritarian regimes. Human rights is crushed. Economic progress is halted. Massive transfers of wealth to the tiny elites at the top and great suffering below. So that's what coups bring us when agencies like the CIA intervene in the political process. So is that what we want in this country? It's insane. And it's short-sighted, and it's cavalier and cynical, as I say.
Peter Dale Scott, you want to chime in here?
No, I entirely agree with this. People who talk this way are talking about the dangers of Trump versus the dangers of the deep state, and both are dangerous. But, you know, at the same time, I'm not as pessimistic as that sounds, because I think that there's still potential from good to come out of both sides, too. And the piece I just wrote for Who, What, Why, I said Trump versus the deep state, that's how the light gets in. I stole a line actually from David, who in turn stole it from Leonard Cohen. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Well, this is very true right now, that the system is cracking, and we're getting messages from the CIA's journalists in the LA Times, New York Times,
Washington Post,
that it's very dangerous when the system is cracking, and I disagree. I think it's very American for the system to crack. I think this has been true over the years. We have had it, of course, with Watergate, and at the time it looked like a horrible mess. But we got the post-Watergate reforms, and we've been losing them recently, but I think we should try and get them all back.
But we also got the Pike and Church commissions.
All kinds of things happened as a result of that. And, for example, it exposed at the very end that the CIA had been not just spying on the anti-war movement, but actually introducing provocateurs into the anti-war movement, so that it ended up, the cracks ended up with restoration of the needed limitations
on power. I think there is a difference between that period when the cracks did let in the light in the 1970s, after anti-war movement and strong movements from below were pushing a government to become more transparent. And as a result, there were these congressional hearings, as you say, in Washington that exposed many of the dark deeds of the CIA, not all of them, as we know, but many of them. But I think the difference today is both sides at war here, the Trump oligarchy, as I put it, and the deep state, are both deeply invested in lies and deception and fake news and alternative facts. We know the intelligence system, that's their tradecraft, and the people who are now flocking on air every night, the so-called liberal channels, even MSNBC, Rachel Maddow show, all the shows on MSNBC are now devoted 24/7 to anti-Russian propaganda. And virtually all of their guests are tied to the deep state, these national security agencies. And on the other hand, you have the Trump people who lie for a living as well. So really, in the clash between these behemoths, I call it Godzilla versus Mothra, because it's hard to say who we should support. And democracy is being crushed in between. I'm not sure that there's a lot of light coming out of this clash.
Peter Dale Scott.
Okay, maybe not right now, but obviously history is always changing, and that's, in fact, a sign of the health of American democracy, that it isn't really stuck in any kind of mode, but is always evolving. And as you pointed out, we do not now have a very strong anti-war movement that we had then, but we do have a new asset that we didn't have back then, and that's the Internet. And I agree with you about not only the mainstream media, but even all the new things that we have, thanks to technology, that people can just press a button and listen to or watch. But it is much easier for people like you and I to share our ideas now. And if Trump is going to really follow through on all the things that he's threatening to do, we may not have a mass movement today, but I'll bet you in 2 or 3 years we will.
You're listening to the Project Censored show. I'm Mickey Huff. We're talking with Peter Dale Scott and David Palbat, and we're discussing the deep state and its trajectory, many of the ramifications of it. We're going to be getting into later that it's not a monolithic entity, of course. But riffing on this, David Talbot, you brought up alternative facts and fake news. And certainly fake news is nothing new. At Project Censored, we've been looking at the problems of propaganda, censorship, misinformation, disinformation for 40 years. So this is definitely not new. But what's new, and I think with Peter Dale Scott saying the crack and the shining of the light, it's becoming increasingly obvious to more people, it seems, in the United States that there is something deeply wrong with the direction that things are taking. For example, had Trump not been elected, we wouldn't have seen all these millions of people in the streets and the Women's March and all of the things that have been going on. They would have likely been somnambulistically rolling along underneath a Hillary Clinton presidency.
I think that the left and the progressive movements in general went to sleep under Obama, and I think that long sleep would have continued under Hillary Clinton as president. And so, yes, Trump has forced the issue in so many ways now, has forced people to rouse themselves from their slumber and take action. Going back to this discussion about whether or not light is coming in as a result of these fractures in the deep state and the daily hue and cry we see now, I think it's more smoke, really, than light. Again, back in the 70s, when you had a massive anti-war movement, when you had a post-Watergate reform movement that elected a number of progressive politicians to Congress, you did have an accountability there to the American people that's missing now. Unfortunately, what we have now is WikiLeaks instead. for good and ill. I have a very complex view of Julian Assange. I think he's a complex figure, and I think he's done an enormous amount of good and enormous amount of perhaps negative things as well. The point about Julian is that he's unaccountable. He's virtually a one-man show, and it's not hard to say who his sponsors are or who his sources are. They have to remain hidden, often for obvious reasons. So there he is operating, unfortunately, in captivity in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because of the U.S. and its efforts to get its hands on him. That may be different now under Trump. Who knows, because of the changing ideology of the American government. But in any case, we're kind of dependent on him for the light these days more and more. And he is not someone that is accountable. There's no editorial board, as far as I know, reviewing his decisions. There's no staff of investigative reporters working with him whose professional resumes we know about. He's a shadowy figure, and again, what he's revealed has been very important in many ways, including the leaks recently about the CIA hack. This is kind of a thin reed for us to defend our democracy with at this point. We need something much bigger. We need a popular movement in this country, not a fake populism like Trump's, but a real populism. We saw inklings of that with the Bernie Sanders movement. Of course, now the media is completely focused away from Bernie and his issues that he was bringing up, the urgent issues of political reform and the corruption of our political system. That's gotten swept under the rug by all this Russian hysteria. So again, the media is, you know, again, doing a great disservice to the American people, just the way they did during the election, by focusing on the latest Trump tweet and not focusing on the issue.
If I could say, David, we have to be careful that we don't over-focus ourselves. And I essentially agree with everything you said about Assange, but I don't attribute as much importance as you do to his role in this thing. I think the Trump-Russia issue, which is huge, and we couldn't begin to adequately deal with it in 1 hour here, but it doesn't really all depend on Assange. It has its own dialectics, and it comes back to the leaks that are coming not via Assange, but by other sources from the intelligence community. I think that they did hear very disturbing things. The NSA picked up messages, and some stuff came to us from Assange, but even if we hadn't had Assange, we would still have, I think, this Trump-Russia issue, and I think it's huge, and I think it's going to generate its own series of leaks and counter-leaks and investigations.
And so that's the problem, I think, Peter, is that you have politics by leaks. And the American people are unable to really determine independently the credibility of these leaks on both sides. I actually happen to think there is some truth on the latest charges and countercharges here. On the one hand, I do believe that Trump and his circle probably did have contacts with Russia during the campaign. We know that. And they probably continue to in ways that are not serving our nation. On the other hand, I believe Trump's charges, there's some truth to that, too, that there was a massive effort by the surveillance agencies to surveil him during the campaign. We do know that two requests were made for FISA warrants by the Obama administration. I'm not sure why the media keeps saying there's no evidence that Trump himself was hacked by the Obama administration. We've seen this. There's reports on this. Trump is overstating it, as is his way, but obviously there's some truth on both sides. The point is, though, that this is a war of leaks and counterleaks that is, I think, often a huge distraction. We're unable to really determine their validity in an independent way. And so what you have is a shadow war going on that is not democratic. It's not open debate based on open facts and transparency. It's a war of spooks.
You've also had, as a part of this whole dialectical process, we had the day after Trump's inauguration, the largest global demonstration that there has ever been. It was the first time you could really say that a global public opinion had been aroused by the dangers that we now face. And I think that's just a harbinger. That's the first bird in the springtime, that we're going to see so much more of this coming from all kinds of communities. The health community about the repeal of Obamacare, the scientific community about attempts to deny the reality of global warming. You're going to see all kinds of mobilizations. You're going to get, I think, if things go as they should go, there should be more and more coalescing of these diverse forces, not just in America. This is a global problem now. I believe that Putin and Trump both are trying to destroy the European Union. They're putting money behind Putin, certainly, putting money behind nationalists in France and Austria and Hungary. It's a very alarming situation, but I'm not scared because it's also a very provocative situation which will, I think, produce, as history always does, a countervailing movement. And sometimes things have to be shaken up like this in order to get the kind of progress that we've, all of us, you and I and Mickey and people, have been waiting for years. When are we going to do something about a system that's being essentially derailed?
Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot, I wanted to chime in that also on an optimistic front, potentially. It's hard to see sometimes optimistic fronts when we're in milieu and in crisis. And I've been using the phrase epistemological crisis, the way that phrases like deep state are being bandied about and fake news are being bandied about.
Right.
I think that it's very abusive to our language, of course. As Oxford Dictionary said last year, the phrase or word of the year was post-truth. But what's coming out of this, I think, coming back to Peter Dale Scott, is that I'm seeing, you know, Peter Phillips and I, you know, Nolan Higdon, you know, we're in the college classrooms and at Project Censored, we're on 20 campuses. We're seeing amazing amounts of mobilization among millennials. And these people are not buying it. They are not buying the fake news meme. It's, in fact, making them more interested in information integrity, critical media literacy. They're asking questions now about what does this mean, deep state, right? And so, I mean, 2007, Peter, you know, that word started to become more of something you used, right?
Right. I used 2006.
But now we're seeing it everywhere, and curiously, even a few years ago, we barely saw it at all. And I'm less interested in the moniker than all that it describes underneath, going back to people like C. Wright Mills.
Yeah. Right. And if I could say, even fake news, I'm not at all sorry to see people talking about fake news, because
indeed,
if you start thinking about it, then you go back to the fact that the day after Oswald was shot, and 3 days after Kennedy was shot, the CIA was already pumping out stories about how Oswald had been to Russia and tried to go to Cuba and was a disgruntled leftist. And it was propaganda. It was fake news.
Of course, the corporate media is now using this whole new debate about the deep state and conspiracy and so forth and tying it around Steve Bannon's neck and Donald Trump's neck, and therefore kind of discrediting the whole notion all over again, saying, look, this is the province of the kooky Trump world.
They're right. More on the defensive now.
I'm just saying that's their pushback. But look, at the end of the day, it's not the sort of war of the titans that's going to save American democracy. It's what we were saying earlier that happened in the 60s and 70s when you had these massive movements, people in the streets, people challenging authority and on civil rights and the war in Vietnam. And it wasn't just Senator Church in Congress and Walter Cronkite on CBS saying, look, you know, we've got to end the war in Vietnam. We've got to reform our government. It was hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people demanding this. And that's what we desperately need today. And we're starting to see signs that the American people are waking up. I once interviewed Chris Hedges, who, of course, was the great journalist who covered for the New York Times the falls of these dictatorships and these societies coming apart in Eastern Europe, the fall of communism and afterwards. And he said that often these governments, these regimes, are like dead men walking. They're dead, but they continue walking for a while before they finally collapse. I'm actually starting to think of the American regime and the power elite and what we've been talking about, the deep state here, in a similar way. I think the system is so obviously corrupt and so obviously ineffectual and really brain dead and unable to really deliver on any substantial needs for the American people, that it is a kind of a cadaver. It's a corpse that's already on its way out. It's just that the collapse could be even more disastrous. You never know what political direction a society can go in as it starts to come apart. So it's important for us, the American people, to come together
to have strong leadership. I don't believe, like Occupy, that the anarchy is the direction we need to go. We need to have structured, and we need to take power back in this country and run people for office at the local, state, and national level and begin to take our country back. And with that, Peter and Mickey, I'm afraid I have to jump off.
Indeed.
Because I'm on a tight deadline.
That's the voice of David Talbot, author most recently of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We're talking about the American deep state. We're joined, of course, also by Peter Dale Scott. I'd like to remind the listeners you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're going to continue our conversation on the American deep state with Peter Dale Scott after this brief musical break. And David Talbot, thank you kindly for joining us on the Project Censored Show today. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's program, we're looking at the deep state in America. And last half hour, we were joined by David Talbot. He is the author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. He's also a columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. We're also joined by Peter Dale Scott, author of The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. Peter Dale Scott remains with us for the rest of the program. Again, gentlemen and scholars both, Peter Dale Scott and David Talbot. So it's an honor to have them back on the Project Censored Show. So Peter Dale Scott, let's chime in where we left off. Right. David Talbot was talking about the responses to this and mobilizing movements and so forth. So what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I agree very strongly with something that David said just before the break, which is that Occupy was not a good model because they offered anarchy. A leaderless movement is not the answer to what this country needs. It has to be organized. It has to be disciplined. But I think you're not going to have a movement that will persuade America and capture American support unless it is nonviolent. And I think we have to be very clear about this. The civil rights movement was successful in the South because it was amazingly nonviolent in the face of incredible provocations and actual deaths. You know, people were being killed, and they went
on. Freedom
rides
and so forth. Yeah, absolutely.
And they went on being nonviolent. I think that we have to be careful that we don't fight the last war, those of us who are progressives. And I think that there were two big mistakes in the anti-war movement. The first one is not so much mistake, but a limitation because of what was available then. We're not going to change this country in the streets. We were able to stop the Vietnam War in the streets. But you know, that very victory meant that Oliver North and a whole bunch of people started planning very seriously how to make sure that a movement in the streets would never do that again. Oliver North actually testified. He said, "We didn't lose the war in Vietnam. We lost it right here in this city." And that's what the core of the planning, they planned for warrantless detention, warrantless surveillance. And you can actually find online the Army handbook on the detention camps. They had a 10-year program called Project Endgame. It started right after 9/11 when COG was introduced, continuity of government. And the budget for 1 year alone was $400 million. They really put a lot of effort. They're already, if we get a big movement in the streets like there was against the Iraq War in 2003, they're ready with all kinds of militarized equipment. For
they
the
just
police.
Shut it down at Standing Rock.
Yes, yes. We saw an example of it at Standing Rock. The really very ugly equipment that blasts your eardrums. There was a no-fly zone at Standing Rock so that the press would not be able to go fly over in their helicopters.
Or drones.
Or drones and see what was happening. It became off limits to the media. The system, the deep political system, is organized to deal with the old-fashioned form of protest. And I believe very strongly that not only do we need a movement that is disciplined, I think it needs to be very decentralized. We have to see centers of activism build up within our institutions, within the universities, within the healthcare system, among the scientists of NASA and other places, as these people are being threatened. And by the way, you know, the threat to the scientific community, I think, is very real and a very big part of this threat that we're dealing with. We had a Trump in Canada for 10 years, a man called Stephen Harper, and what they did was really criminal. They took over agencies and immediately ordered the destruction of files that went back for decades. Scientific data was destroyed.
Well, we were seeing that threat of that here.
Yes, and we should anticipate it and make sure it cannot succeed. But that means there has to be organization. And the overall idea is you organize within specific industries, communities. You know, David was very gloomy about Washington. I think there are a lot of good people still in Washington, and they're very skilled at taking care of themselves. You cannot begin to define all the things that are going to happen in the next 4 years, but I think it's going to be, after a relatively sleepy period under Obama, it's going to be a very active period, and should be. And the point, coming back to the importance of the split between Trump and the deep state, it's a crude way of putting it, but there's something real behind it, and light will be shed. And of course, light by itself is no good unless you do something. If the light doesn't help arouse protests at what's being revealed, then it's a waste of time. But I think this is a country which is very good at responding to the truth when it leaks out. And if there's a gap between what the truth is and what the government is saying it is, either side in this dispute, then the people have to stand up and fight for truth. As Milton said centuries ago, the voice of reason and truth is a small voice, but in the long run, it will be heard. I've seen a great deal since Trump was elected, a great deal of anger, that's okay, a great deal of hatred, not so good, a great deal of despair, and I think despair is the most dangerous of all. There is no reason to despair. Let me say, things were pretty desperate back in the time of Joe McCarthy, which I remember very vividly. And people wondered, are we going to become like the Soviet Union? And of course, we didn't. And the Joe McCarthy era was a very bad era, out of which good things happened. We got a bunch of very good Supreme Court rulings which defanged the anti-communism that wasn't just Joe McCarthy by any means. It was the FBI. It was inside the State Department. It was all over the place. But we outgrew it. I thought nothing could be worse than the election and the re-election of Richard Nixon. Well, things have been worse since then, but it was bad, and we outgrew the crisis of that period. Every country in the world, if they're a big power, they're a flawed power, because power corrupts. There's a great deal of power in here and in Russia and in China and in India, and power corrupts. And all these societies are corrupt in various ways. But I would say, in terms of fighting the corruption, dealing with corruption, I think America's still out ahead of the others. It's deeply flawed, but it's also very conscious of its flaws, and that's what you need. And so I have a phrase that, yes, we should protest, we do, but, you know, in the old days, I saw it in Berkeley in the 60s and 70s, these people hated America. They always spelled it with three Ks instead of a C, and they wanted not to improve the country, they wanted to smash the system, which was insanity. I mean, Nixon was insane too, but it was insane to think that if you destroyed the system, something good would come out of it, because people would start starving to death. We cannot just go retire to our garden plots and support ourselves. No, it was crazy. And so we should not over-idealize. We should learn from the successes of the past, but we should learn that everything is flawed when it becomes powerful. And the anti-war movement, when it became powerful, was also flawed. So with all humility, we should learn from the past and have faith that this is a country where if you struggle for truth, you can make something happen.
Basically saying, like, we've been through times, we've been through trials and tribulations.
That's the advantage of being 88, you know. I'm used to seeing an appalling situation in Washington. It can be overcome.
Well, these appalling situations seem to get relatively or contextually worse in my half as much time on the planet as you've been. And so the Trump years kind of, you see, we get these lovely rewrites. So now in the Trump administration, we're seeing George W. Bush suddenly see some brief resurgence of, hey, remember the days of W. Bush weren't that bad. And of course, we saw the Nixon refurbishing.
Yes. Right? When he Reagan.
Real indeed.
His first 4 years, he was so anti-Russian. But in the end, he got so swayed by the rhetoric of Gorbachev that he terrified the advisors who were with him there in Reykjavik. That was a very important moment.
Indeed. Well, Peter Dale Scott, let's go to the deep state, because you've been following this for ages. Mm-hmm. But we've recently seen so many references to, quote, the deep state, that the definitions, they seem to have flown out the window.
I don't think you can really define the deep state. The deep state is the indefinable excess of power that is not captured and limited in the Constitution. And that was the example, really, of Turkey, that they were describing something they didn't fully know about. And I think we're all in the same status. By the way, you know, I'm reissuing a paperback edition of The American Deep State, and a significant subtitle. Well, now, it used to be Wall Street Big Oil, and it's now going to be Big Money and Big Oil, because we have to deal precisely with awareness of a whole level of combat between very rich people, in which Wall Street is more like a faction than the whole. The old Wall Street is still there, and, you know, as I said, in Who, What, Why, I think three of the past four Treasury secretaries, including Mnuchin, the new one for Trump, have come from Goldman Sachs. So fulfilling what Jeffrey Sachs had to say about Goldman Sachs, which is that there is an axis there, the axis that C. Wright Mills was talking about a half a century ago between Wall Street and Washington. It's still there. But this other faction, the Goldwater faction, which never really, by the way, became a serious faction in American power until something most people don't know about, which is the Halloween Massacre of October 31st, 1975. And it was engineered in the Ford administration by his chief of staff and his deputy, and those two men were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And if there was ever a coup d'etat, it was not illegal. It was just firing people. But some very significant things happened. William Colby, who had been collaborating with Congress about revealing CIA secrets, was fired. He was replaced by George H.W. Bush, who brought in something called Team B, who reassessed the Soviet threat and said it was far, far greater than what the experts had been saying, and it was also far, far greater than it really was. But it led to a huge expansion of the defense budget that really began under Carter, of all people, but is usually remembered as the Reagan budget increases, but it began under Carter. But the main thing is that Goldwater faction, which is a real, it's not that they want the government to do something different. They don't like government. They don't want America to be governed. It's wanted, you know, one of those people said, I'd like to shrink
Grover Norquist.
Yes, Norquist. I'd like to shrink the bureaucracy until we can drown it in a bathtub. And with all the problems we face with an increasingly complex society and increasingly heavy impact on the environment, we need government. Maybe Trump will clean up some things that we shouldn't have. I don't say it's going to be all bad, but the Goldwater idea that we can get along with just the armed forces and not much else, and maybe then they debate about whether you have Social Security or not. No, we need government. And there are times when the people have to step in, not just to restrain the government, but now, in essence, to preserve certain features. I mean, there, a lot of old radicals are now really cast in the role of conservative. We're trying to conserve the Constitution. It's not an ideal Constitution, but it's better than the alternatives that are being proposed.
Or conserve the EPA,
yeah,
which came from Nixon.
All those institutions. But, you know, there's a threat now with 33 state legislatures in the control of the Republicans. There's the risk of a constitutional convention, and they may call it on one issue, but if you call it, it can do anything. And so... I mean, I too would like to change the Constitution in certain ways, but I don't trust the 33 Republican legislatures to give us a path to a better alternative. So that makes me a conservative, to my amazement.
Not a strange way of looking at it, however, right? When you can explain that. And it also, I think, helps people understand the many shifts or the shifting baselines.
Right. And I would like America, everyone listening to this broadcast, to share the concern that David and I and you, Mickey, have about where we are right now and see that it really is dangerous, but also to see that there are also possibilities arising out of this chaos. You know, Schumpeter said, creative destruction. And we're a bit in that kind of period. There is hope out of all this, and we should really much shouldn't be focusing on the despair, because it's very easy. I certainly understand people who despair. Some very close friends of mine are really despairing, and they won't listen to an 88-year-old who say it's been bad before. But there's also hope, and you have to see. I think the fact that tacitly in Syria we are not now trying to unseat Assad, we are trying to get rid of ISIS. I don't like American troops in the Middle East at all. But if they're going to be there, this is a better target. And I, even from the very beginning, when ISIS was threatening to seize the capital of Kurdistan in northern Iraq, I approved of the drone attacks and the Air Force attacks that blunted that effort. I don't say that American power is always wrong, wherever it is, but there's far too much of it and in far too many countries, and we are quietly escalating the U.S. attacks in Yemen, Somalia. I mean, I'm not even up to date on how many countries we're fighting in now. That's how bad it is, and it's a sign of a system that's gone berserk. And in my book, by the way, I talk about how the Pax Britannica worked reasonably well at the beginning, but it became too powerful and very excessive, and it actually produced the tensions that resulted in World War I. We do not want Americana to produce the tensions that will result in World War III. That would really negate all of the positive things that have been achieved in making a more peaceful and global world. There have been real achievements, and particularly technical achievements. The internet is such a promising thing, but everyone should know that if we have put enough people in the streets, they have the plans ready to push a button and close it down. And they can do it selectively, just in California, or they can do it nationally. That's the kind of threat we face, and that's why we need a different kind of opposition now that is multi-based in many places, is working within the system, trying to preserve and improve the system, not to smash the system.
We need a truly free press in order to encourage and support all of these kinds of events.
Yes, well, we need open communications and an open society. We certainly do.
Well, Peter Dale Scott, your recent articles can be found over at Russ Baker's site, whowhatwhy.org, and you actually have a two-part series of articles that listeners can check out. It's called Donald J. Trump and the Deep State, Parts 1 and 2, and in fact, you conclude the Part 2 of these pieces on a note that's very similar to this, when you say, so many times before in U.S. history, we're entering another period of divisions and protests, but a successful protest of the nonviolent kind you hope for, and this is what you had been writing in your books, right, that must be inspired by deeply critical love of this flawed country and not by hatred. It's an honor to have you back on the program. Peter Dale Scott, author of so many books and important articles, one crucially related to this conversation. Of course, The Road to 9/11 is one, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. But the other, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. We were joined earlier on the program.
Okay, can I throw in one more?
Please.
Also at Who, What, Why. Trump versus the Deep State. : That's how the light gets in.
Indeed.
Quoting from Leonard Cohen.
And we were joined earlier by journalist David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Thanks so much to the guests today on the program, and thank you, Peter Dale Scott.
Thank you, Mickey, and thanks to Project Censored. You do a very valuable service for this country.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Executive producers, myself, Mickey Huff, along with Peter Phillips. Our producer is Anthony Fest, and Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on roughly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Prepared about criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies of God.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. In memory of Bertolt Brecht. In 1998, I had the extraordinary luck and privilege to be allowed to record the performance of Happy Birthday Brecht by the Royal National Theatre from London. They performed in San Francisco on the stage of Project Artaud. Now in August of 2017, I'm sending out the only recording made of that event to remember Bertolt Brecht's passing in August of 1956. and because some of the references to the rise of fascism seem eerily contemporary. Here's the tribute to Bertolt Brecht that last went out in 2013. Happy birthday, Bertolt Brecht. The 100th birthday in 1998 of the playwright, director, poet, and theoretician of the stage, Bertolt Brecht, was celebrated all across the world, not just in his native Germany. But the performance by the Royal National Theatre from London, under the first formidable woman director, Di Travis, in San Francisco, was one of the few events in the U.S. Happy Birthday Brecht was presented in a converted factory in my former home at Project Arto in San Francisco's industrial zone, and I was given permission to record the songs during their dress rehearsal. The six-member company performed songs, read poetry and excerpts from the plays, and gave a sketch of Brecht's extraordinary work that influenced major visual and performance artists such as Jean-Luc Godard, Robert Wilson, Rainer Werner Fassbinder, Augusto Boal, Pina Bausch, Dario Fo, and many others. Born in 1898 near Munich, Germany, Brecht was drafted a month before the end of World War I and became part of the group of artists who were so shocked and angered by the terrible slaughter of that war that they put all their energy and passion into preventing another. Brecht's life in the 1920s in the German Weimar Republic was driven by that passion and the desire to create a new political and social life after the fall of the imperial monarchy. These artists, and Brecht foremost among them, challenged the economic system and capitalism that had revealed itself as the driving force for war. For several years in the 1920s, it looked as if a new, just, egalitarian social democracy might emerge. However, the dark indicators of Hitler's rise to power in 1933 were foreshadowing in Brecht's and other artists' work and in their life experience. Brecht wrote over 60 plays, the first ones Baal and Drums in the Night, when he was only 20 years young. In that first group of plays through 1930 are those that made him world famous, such as the Threepenny Opera and the Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. Already in 1923, on the opening night of Brecht's play In the Jungle, a gang of Nazis blew whistles and threw stink bombs onto the stage. This became a feature of many Brecht performances. Up to the premiere of the Mahagoni in 1930, it was disrupted by Nazis in Leipzig, but then became a triumph and sensation when it opened in Berlin a year later. Years before Hitler was brought to power, a paramilitary Nazi party organization, the SA, or Brownshirts, started roaming the streets of Germany, attacking labor and social change rallies. The performance of Happy Birthday Brecht by the Royal National Theatre included the moving Song of the S.A. Man, written by Brecht and composed by his close friend Hans Eisler. Here is Christopher Peake, accompanied by Michael Morley on piano.
My hunger made me fall asleep with a bellyache. Then I heard voices crying, "Hey, Germany, awake." Then I saw crowds of men marching to the Third Reich. I heard them say, I thought, as I'd nothing left to live for, I might as well march their way. As I was marching in step beside me, marched a belly fat and round.
And as my cry went up for jobs and bread, that belly echoed the sound. I thought that the left road led forward, but he marched to the right. I went the way that they ordered and blindly marched into the night. And all those crying out for bread, a worn out gray face band, marched next to bellies that were well fed into Hitler's promised land. They told me which enemy to shoot at, so I took up their gun and aimed. But when I had shot, I found my brother was the enemy they had named. I thought, that's my brother over there. We both are hungry and poor. But I went marching, marching off to our enemy's war. So now my brother is dying. By my own hand he fell. I can't grasp that if he is defeated, I shall be lost as well. I can't grasp that if he is defeated, I shall be lost as well.
Song of the S.A. Man, written to be performed in one of the many workers' cabarets that existed in 1920s Germany, along with workers' newspapers, evening schools, co-ops, and other mutual aid organizations that were also targeted by the Nazis. Bertolt Brecht and many other artists were courageously and proudly progressives, socialists, or communists. So when Hitler and the Nazi Party actually assumed state power in 1933, they were all marked, and most of them left the country immediately. They became exiles with often no idea where to go and how to survive. Brecht by then had a small family, and the question was where to go into exile. He spent some time in Paris working on a ballet opera, The Seven Deadly Sins. The composer Kurt Weill, who had also written the music for Three Penny Opera and The Mahogany, wrote the score for The Seven Deadly Sins.
You gentlemen who think you have a mission to purge us of the seven deadly sins
should first sort out the basic food position, then start your preaching. That's where it begins.
You lot who preach restraint and watch your waste as well
should learn for all time how the world is run.
However much you twist, whatever lies you tell,
food is the first thing, morals follow on. So first make sure that those who now are starving get proper helpings when we all start carving.
What keeps mankind alive?
What keeps mankind alive? Kind alive, the fact that millions are daily tortured, stifled, punished, silenced, oppressed. Mankind can keep alive thanks to its brilliance at keeping its humanity repressed.
for once you must try not to shirk the facts. Mankind is kept alive by bestial acts.
Di Travis Company with the Seven Deadly Sins. This was the last collaboration between Kurt Weill and Brecht. Weill never returned to Germany. He died in exile in New York in 1950. From Paris, Brecht went to Denmark, where friends offered him and his family a home. They settled in a house in Svendborg, on an island across from Copenhagen, where they were able to stay for the next 6 years. From now on, the radio would be the only connection to home and also eventually carry the terrible news about the beginning of World War II. At the Happy Birthday Brecht performance, Craig Swager sang the song to a portable radio.
You little box I carried on that trip, concerned to save your works from getting broken, fleeing from house to train, from train to ship, so I might hear the hated jargon spoken beside my bedside and to give me pain. Last thing at night, once more as dawn appears, charting their victories. And my worst fears, promise at least you won't fall silent now.
With mounting anguish, Brecht and the other exiles followed the news of the descent into fascism at home. On September 15, 1935, the Nuremberg Laws were enacted. They were depriving German Jews of their citizenship, forbidding them to marry Aryans or have sexual relations with them. Brecht wrote the poem about the, quote, Jewish whore, Marie Sanders, and Eisler set it to music. Here's Jenny Galloway.
In Nuremberg they enacted a law, and many a woman wept who'd not been sleeping with the proper breed of men. The price is rising for butcher's meat, the drumming's now at its height. God alive, if they are coming down our street, it'll be tonight. Mary Sanders, your lover's hair is far too black. Take our advice and don't you be to him what you were yesterday. The price is rising for butcher's meat, the drumming's now at its height. God alive, if they are coming down our street, it'll be tonight. Mother, give me the latchkey, it can't really be so bad. The moon's as bright as ever. Is rising for butcher's meat, the drumming's now at its height. God alive, if they are coming down our street, it'll be tonight. But one morning close on nine, she was driven through the town, round her neck a sign, her hair all shaven. The street was yelling. She stared ahead.
butchers' meat and strikers speaking tonight. God alive, if they could understand his speech, they would know who it is they should fight.
In the exile in Denmark, Brecht wrote the series of Swedenborg poems. One of the most moving is the song To Those Born Later, also listed under the title You Who Will Come to the Surface. It was written in 1938, and Brecht and his family had only one more year of safety until they had to move again. Jonah Newhall sings To Those Born Later, composed by Hans Eisler.
You who will come to the surface of the overwhelming deluge that covered us, just think when you complain about our weakness of those dark times which all of you escaped. Yes, we went as often changing countries as changing shoes, through the wars of the classes, despairing each time we found an abuse and no sense of outrage. All the same, we realize even hatred of debasement can distort your features. Even anger at injustices can make your voice hoarse. Oh, we who always hoped to prepare a basis for friendliness never could be friendly ourselves. You, though, when things are moving forward so that man becomes a helper to other men, look back on us with indulgence.
When war seemed imminent in April 1939, the Brecht family moved to Sweden, where they remained for a year. Then Hitler invaded Norway and Denmark, and Brecht was forced to leave for Finland. While waiting for visas for the United States, Brecht wrote, in only 3 weeks, one of his most searing, funny, frightening, and historically accurate plays against Hitler, The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy, presented all major Nazis, as well as their supporters, masked as members of a mafia operation. The play followed precisely the stages of the seizure of power and posed the most important question: could Hitler's rise have been stopped? Brecht received his visa to the US and left Finland on May 3, 1941, but he was unable to find a producer for the Arturo Uy play, and it was not seen on stage until 1958. By then, some argue, Nazism had made a recovery, not only in Germany. During the war years, Brecht became a prominent writer of the literature in exile. He expressed his opposition to the National Socialist and Fascist movements in his most famous plays, Mother Courage and Her Children, The Good Person of Szechuan, The Caucasian Chalk Circle, Fear and Misery of the Third Reich, and The Life of Galileo, a play that he revised after the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When the family arrived in Santa Monica, California, Brecht found it impossible to make a living. Living for the first time in an American city, Brecht joked that he had come to Mars. In his Hollywood elegies, he described how the new paradise he found himself in was possibly more like hell, because in hell, too, he wrote, quote, "There are, I've no doubt, flowers as big as trees,
which of course die if not nourished with very expensive water, and fruit markets with great heaps of fruit, albeit having neither smell nor taste. He is Christopher Peake with Hollywood Elegy.
This old city has made me realize paradise and hellfire are the same city. For those without money,
Brecht's only Hollywood job was the writing of the screenplay for the film Hangmen Also Die. This was loosely based on the 1942 assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, a chief architect of the Holocaust who was known as the Hangman of Prague. In a shocking reversal of circumstances, the persecuted anti-fascist Brecht became persecuted again, this time as suspected communist. This included being hauled before HUAC in September 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee. The day after his testimony, Brecht left the U.S. East Germany, the DDR, offered him a theater, and he returned to Berlin in 1949. He had a fair amount of artistic freedom and produced a huge body of performances and writings in the last 9 years of his life. However, his work was trapped behind the Iron Curtain and became difficult to access. Meanwhile, in the so-called West, Brecht's work began to find its own expression. The Song of the Moldau, written in 1943, became popular as part of one of Brecht's great anti-war plays, Schweik in the Second World War. It was also part of the performance of Happy Birthday, Brecht.
Deep down in the Moldau, the pebbles are shifting. In Prague, three dead emperors molder away. The top won't stay top, for the bottom is lifting. The night has 12 hours, and then comes the day, and then comes the day. But time can't be halted. The boundless ambition of those now in power is running its course.
Like blood-spattered cocks, they will fight for position. But time can't be halted, not even by force, not even by force.
Moldau, the pebbles are shifting. In Prague, three dead emperors molder away. The top won't stay top, for the bottom is lifting. The night has 12 hours, and then comes the day, and then comes the day.
Song of the Moldau, sung by the cast of Happy Birthday, Brecht. And finally, to close, the song All of Us or None, written in exile in Denmark as one of the Swedenborg poems, set by Hans Eisler in 1934 and sung by the international brigades that were fighting the fascists in Spain. All of Us or None was later included in Brecht's 1948 play, Days of the Commune, about the first workers' revolution of the industrial age that governed Paris for 2 months in 1871. All of us or none.
Slaves, say, who is going to free you? Those in deepest darkness lying, comrade, they will hear you crying. Through the blackness they will see you. Slaves just like yourself will free you. Everything or nothing. All of us or none. None gets through without assistance. Surrender or resistance. Everything or nothing. All of us or none.
All of us or none. Sung by the members of the Royal National Theatre London at their 1998 visit in San Francisco. Happy Birthday Brecht for his 100th birthday was directed by Di Travis and musical director Michael Morley. All songs recorded by me, Mariah Gelarden. This was a rebroadcast of my tribute to Bertolt Brecht in remembrance of his passing in August of 1956. And because some of the references to the rise of fascism seem eerily contemporary. And also to celebrate now 25 years of TUC Radio. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Your sanity depends on your collective organization. And we are in a state now, in this moment, in this historical moment, We are in a state that we are self-destructing ourselves. And that certainly got to do with the collective rituals we are performing. And if we can train actors and train people and gather people that are interested in performing different rituals, we can change the community's mental health.
That's the voice of Dr. Victor Portillos. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Portillos about his latest theories of how performance can act as a tool for healing in the world. Stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning to have Brazilian physician, actor, and transcultural psychiatrist, Dr. Victor Portillos. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure. I thank you, Sylvia.
Now, one of the most amazing things that happened to me recently at a conference was meeting you and being introduced to the Madness Hotel. Tell us a little bit about this project and how you got started.
Well, the Madness Hotel started in 2012 in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and we had occupied abandoned wards in the oldest hospice, which is the oldest Brazilian psychiatric hospital. And in this place, we created a theater that was before, in 2011. And we have an artistic residency program for collectives, and we have more than 13 collectives working in those 3 years of occupation. And we do it public spectacles, we do public performances, and we train actors. So many of our actors that are training with us, and some of them are performing really well, many of them have had the diagnosis of schizophrenia and chronic psychosis, which are the most severe forms of mental illness. So the greatest thing about this work is when you observe the evolution of people with a psychiatric disease that is considered to be very severe, and through the actors' training, through the occupation of spaces, and through the realization of pageants and public parties in the squares close to the hospital and also in the squares of the city, we can see the transformation of the person. So the patient starts to develop his ability to speak, his ability to dance, to relate to the other people. And that seems to be a very important factor in mental illnesses.
We live in a world that is sick. You know, when you think about all the wars, all the inequality, all the poverty and injustice, it almost seems that it is illogical to be well in a society that is so dis-ease.
Yes.
So can we talk about that? What is mental illness at its heart?
Yes, we are facing a moment of a crisis that manifests itself in mental illnesses in the individuals, in the population. And we are seeing really high levels of violence, of wars, of violent attacks, killings, lack of consciousness. Like a lot of people is going into unconsciousness and is succumbing to destructive impulses and making destructive acts that we understand are acts provoked by madness, by unconsciousness, by the lack of the control of your attitudes and consciousness of your own body and your own mind. Well, that happens in our understanding due to cultural factors, social factors, economic factors. The World Health Organization has published just in November last year a report called Social Determinants of Mental Health, where they show that the poorer, the people with less resources, with a lower socioeconomic status, with a lower educational level, they have more mental illnesses. And they have more depression and more anxiety syndromes, and they have more psychosis, have more schizophrenia. This report shed light showing that even mental illnesses is considered to be less severe such as depression and anxiety syndromes, they also occur and more violently and with poorer prognosis in patients with low income, with low educational level. And that's true not only for mental diseases, but also for general diseases. The poor people, and as more poor you are, more strokes, more heart attacks, more cancer, worse prognosis. We know from literature, from public health literature, that the poor people, poor populations, they are dying from 5 to 10 years before. So there's something going on that we keep killing generations of people because of their socioeconomic status. And this happens to have lower literacy and without education, without the word, without the control of the word. It's worse for you to control yourself. It's worse for you to control the psychotic symptoms. Also the violence, the traumas, the transgenerational traumas. That means, like in Brazil, in my country, a very powerful trauma that we deal in patients, in psychiatric patients, is slavery, because we have a lot of black patients living in subhuman conditions and developing very severe mental illnesses. And we understand that this goes back to slavery, and that's a public debate that has to happen. So what is really important to understand is that the mold we live, the mold we behave, the way we construct our houses, the way we construct our cities, the way we get dressed, the way we eat, the kind of performances that we do, the kind of theater that we do or we don't do, the excess of television that we see, all this interferes with our mode of thinking, with our consciousness, with the ideas we have. What our work has been showing, that when you develop creative cultural activities in a favorable environment, an effective environment where people is well treated, where people is well received, where people is stimulated to express themselves and stimulated to talk and have relationships in the collective, you see that severe mental illnesses that are characterized by isolation from the world, they start to heal. And we have many stories and many cases of people who had a long time inside the hospital, like 31 years of the hospitalization, that due to this theatrical and open performances, pageants and processions, and public spectacles, this person started to circulate in the city, and for 2 years now she's living outside the hospital. And many other cases, another case of schizophrenia with aggressive, very aggressive teacher, where the theater had a very important teaching on the sense of developing relationship to the other in the space and how to control yourself. So it seems that the cultural practice, the ritual practice, is vital for mental health. Since people is going mad because of culture, I believe through culture we can revert this mechanism.
I love that you bring that up. There are so many ways that I want to engage this conversation. One, I just want to quickly address that, you know, it makes complete sense to me that a history of injustice and slavery would have an impact in the way we internalize, you know, oppression, in the way that we have learned and forgotten who we really are. And I think the theater perhaps is not so much about control, but rather about becoming whole, you know, integrating all the pieces that we have disowned, our anger, righteous anger, because we have a right to be angered at a society that has been so dehumanizing to some of our people, to some of our, you know, and the ways that we have forgotten who we are, you know, this ability to be creators, to be creative, and to participate as a whole. So can we talk a little bit about the rituals then that we cultivate and how they transform and inform who we are.
Exactly. In our society, in our mass society, people and me as a child and everybody as child and we as children, we were educated to watch television and to swallow television and to swallow what television tell us every day and all kinds of information and commercials and marketing has entered inside our bodies and our minds. And when I started developing the training for actors and theater, and we have to understand theater in the Brazilian context, because theater in the Brazilian context has a much stronger dialogue with indigenous culture in Brazil, with African culture in Brazil. So theater in Brazil reacquires a ritual quality, a public ritual quality, a community ritual quality that is, I can't perceive this in North America, in more industrialized countries, because we have this regaining of this of this ancestral body, thankfully to the Africans and the indigenous populations from Brazil. And when you start doing this training, you see that people is like unaccustomed to act, and they don't feel free to act, and they have difficulties in dancing, they have difficulties in speaking, they have difficulties in declaiming poetry, and that's, I think, reflects cultural alienation. That reflects the general state of cultural alienation of our population, because we are inducted to perform the machine's ritual, which is television and movies, isn't it? Where you sit in a dark room and you swallow all the content and you don't act and you don't create. And when we start to train the actors and people and communities and groups in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, and also in other parts of Brazil, we see that this cultural alienation, that is the alienation from the own affection, from the own body, it starts to disappear, and the person starts to gain more freedom of movement and gain more pleasure of movement and gain expression. And that's the change in the ritual. That's the change in the ritual from rituals that treat you as cows, that treat you as a mass that only accepts and only swallows contents, to rituals that are all the rituals from popular culture. All popular culture parts, the carnivals, the public fairs, the Middle Age fairs, the traditional parties, all of them, everybody's an actor. Everybody acts and everybody sings. All popular culture, all public culture was developed over this idea that everybody is an actor. When Shakespeare, in the 17th century, he said that every woman and man are actors, and the world is a stage, he was saying that because Shakespeare himself, he was a public performer. He was a popular culture derived person. He would perform in the open spaces. He would walk in the whole country, performing in different cities, in different spaces, in squares, in public squares. He would perform in London, in the Brussels, in the worst region for morality, where they had bear baiting, bear fightings, and cock fightings. So theater, it's an extremely open space, public, popular party and ritual. And what happened in modern society is that ritual was, let's say, mutilated and was modified. What I think we could perceive and experience in Brazil was this kind of theater that reencounters the African rituals, that reencounters the indigenous rituals, the healing rituals. And that's why I am convinced that theater, actually, it's a healing ritual. It belongs to a healing tradition. That's why theater had always worked along and very connected to medicine in Greece. And that's why the shamans and the indigenous healers, they don't separate the medicine from theater. And also the African rites, you don't separate the theater, the public rite and the dance and the singing from the daily life, from the sacred daily life that means to be that. And I think this can be multiplied. It's a tradition. It's something old. It's not something new. And we are now focused in training more people and training more actors to work on communities and work on territories and work in public spaces. And this is the tradition that I had been trained in Brazil. And this training has benefited my own mental health. So I'm applying what I had experienced with me. I'm not giving electroshocks and drugs to anyone. I'm doing what I have done, and it's working quite beautifully. And now I'm writing this thesis about this work in the McGill University here in Montreal, where I am now in Canada. But I'll be in Brazil in March to start the new spectacle that we are performing. And it's working, and we hope it can keep working. And we have a lot of published material in the internet. We have BBC pieces and English articles about our work. And I hope that everybody can access it and can also practice these ideas and practice this kind of rituals and cultural rituals. One theater master from Brazil, he told me that. He said, theater is a ritual, and we have to make our own ritual. The ritual has to reflect the story, the memories of the territory. It has to make to bring people's memory in order they can understand better who they are, which is your identity. And with your identity, you develop self-esteem. With self-esteem, you develop self-care and care for the other.
Beautiful.
And that seems to be a pathway to construct health.
I'd love to hear a little more about your Dionysus Theater, because most people are not instructed in the arts. You know, education today is designed to get people to become cogs, you know, cogs in the machinery of production, right? So how do you get a job? How do you get a job? That's the only impetus. But Dionysus Theater is this awakening movement of, you know, so who is Dionysus, and why does this speak to the core of your work?
Yes, that's very important in our research, because back in Brazil, we have in our psychiatric hospital, we have this woman doctor, psychiatrist, called Nise da Silveira. Nise da Silveira. She was a revolutionary of psychiatry back in the 40s, and she refused to treat the patients with aggressive methods, such as electroshocks and lobotomies, and which are surgeries that the patients have a part of his brain cutted by surgery to disable some neuronal circuits in this kind of violence, and she refused to do that, and she started to work with painting and sculpting and many different occupational therapies, and that led her to build the largest museum for art and psychiatry in the world, which is the Museum of Images of the Unconscious. And she worked with Carl Jung in Zurich. And she developed this look into psychosis that derived from Jung's theory. When we are mentally ill, we express mythological figures. We express myths. We express stories. We express narratives. And these narratives are not new at all. They are old, and they are influenced by old myths, by old religions. And everybody who works in psychotic populations and people with severe mental illness knows that Dionysus, the god of madness, the god of theater, the god of wine in Greek culture, is a very abundant archetype in madness. The Greek, they didn't put they put the same god, Dionysus, for madness and for theater. That's not a coincidence. The same god that controls madness is the same god that controls theater. And his brother, Apollo, controls medicine and controls poetry. So the Greek, they knew already that there is a very fine balance between Dionysus and Apollo, and that Apollo is the healer and Dionysus is the theater maker and is the mad guy, is the one who has inspired madness. And we have been working this in the hospital. In 2013, we played the Bacchae, which is a play by Euripides. It's a Greek playwright that wrote this play called the Bacchae, making reference to Baco, which is the Roman name for Dionysus. And it narrates the story of this god, which is Dionysus, the god of madness, the god of theater. And it's a very interesting myth because Dionysus makes people mad. When he arrives in the city, the women, they go mad, they take out the clothing, and they drink wine, and they dance and sing in his honor. This is the beginning of the Dionysian rites and the pageants and the public parties and the first carnivals of history, isn't it? They started like this. And out of this, the Greek theater evolved to the tragedy, to the comedy, and also democracy was created in the environment of the Greek theater, in the theater of Dionysos in Athens. So we worked with this idea, understanding that Dionysus symbolizes the collectivity, the dialogue, symbolizes the group, symbolizes the enthusiasm, the idea that we are all dancing and singing in his honor. The Greek, they had this very important word, which is called entheos. Entheos in Greek means the god inside, the god within. And entheos is the root for the word enthusiasm. So whenever you are enthusiastic about something, is that the moment when God manifests on you. And that God is Dionysus, is the God of ecstasy, is the God of party, of theater. And also it has a dark side that when people doesn't honor his traditions, when people don't dance, when a city stops to dance, Dionysus punishes with madness. And that's a very interesting metaphor for understanding this idea that your sanity depends on your collective expression.
Beautiful.
Your sanity depends on your collective organization. And we are in a state now in this moment, in this historical moment, we are in a state that we are self-destructing ourselves. And that certainly got to do with the collective rituals we are performing. And if we can train actors and train people and gather people that are interested in performing different rituals, we can change the community's mental health. We have been doing this in Brazil, and it's progressing for 7 years now.
We're coming to the end of our interview, so I wonder if you'd like to recite for us one of your poems or favorite poems that calls you.
A Brazilian poet that I love very much, which is called Carlos Drummond de Andrade. Carlos Drummond de Andrade is one of the greatest Brazilian poets, and he had been helping us very much. He's dead for a few decades, but his poetry is really feeding us and helping us every day, and we have been saying this. He says this poem, it's called in Portuguese, Mãos Dadas, which in English means joined hands. And he says, I won't be the poet of a decrepit world, neither I'll sing the future world. I'm arrested to life and I look to my companions. They are quite sad, but they nourish great hopes. Among them, I look to reality. The present is so huge. Do not separate us. Do not separate us much. Let us go in joined hands. I won't be the singer of a woman of the sight scene from the window. I won't distribute suicidal letters, neither psychotropics. I won't flee to the islands, neither I'll be kidnapped by seraphs. The time is my matter. Time present, men present, and life present. It's called Joined Hands by Carlos Drummond de Andrade.
Beautiful. I want to remind our audience that you are not just a poet, a theater, you know, magician, but you also do free trainings. Can you tell us about your latest project?
And we are training more actors. Here in Montreal, we are starting it today, and we're going to go through the whole year, the whole next year at least. And in Brazil also, we keep performing and we keep training. We have open workshops in the Madness Hotel, which is in the Nise da Silveira Institute in Rio de Janeiro. And people who want to visit and want to come and train with us. There is the site, the matrix of all this work, but we are doing it abroad now. And also, I'm publishing a lot of stuff and publishing papers, and I hope people can read it and join this collaborative network, this cultural collaborative network. I always ask, why should we compete when we can cooperate? So to cooperate is much better, much easier, much faster, much efficient, much more efficient, and we can do it collaboratively. So this is a hope for us, because this competitive culture, it's truly exhausted. People is going mad because of it, and it seems to me that to perform a culture, to perform a healing ritual, to perform spectacles, to perform plays, to perform movies, to do cultural works in a collaborative fashion has a striking importance today for offering examples of new modes of working that do not are connected to this idea of competition and that you have to be the best and this kind of crap that people say in our education process.
Mm. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a truly delight. My guest is Victor Pordeaux. Dr. Victor Pordeaux is not just, I mean, you're brilliant. He's a brilliant physician, actor, and transcultural psychiatrist. And he's the founder of Dionysus Theater, also the Madness Hotel and Spa, and the People's University for Art and Science.
And thank you very much, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.